Call the meeting to order for Stan Sarah. Start with roll call.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Jeff Groba.
Here.
Jim DeMartini. Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jason Bordo.
Here.
Joan Clendenin.
Here.
Maria DeAnda. We have a quorum.
Any announcements? Oh, yeah, any announcements?
Yes, I do have an announcement that item 8A will be pulled and presented next meeting. That item is being pulled as it was not listed as a discussion and action item, so we'll be unable to take any action on that item.
8A, okay.
It's the PEMCO modification to cash equivalent.
And just in case you haven't noticed, Fred's not here yet, so he's sent out a message to him today.
I did see him earlier today. He will be here.
Okay.
Any other announcements? Public comment. We don't have members of the public. Consent items. Anybody need to pull any consent items or modifications?
Make a motion to approve the consent items listed on the agenda.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay, we go to item 6. Annual update report. Legato.
Have Adam and Doug from Legato to give their performance and firm update.
Great. Thanks for having us. I'm Adam Muller. This is Doug Porter. Just a brief update on the organization. At the end of the first quarter, we finished with our assets greater than $2 billion under management. That's an all-time high for us. So firm is doing well. It's stable. We're up to 13 employees. We brought on two new employees during the first quarter, Scott Ohm, who as a product specialist, and Heather McDonald, an administrative support. We also have an additional administrative temp to hire position that should, if we were to decide to go forward, be brought on by the end of the quarter, maybe in July. So. Firm is doing well. We launched a new product in the beginning of the quarter, an international equity strategy for a client, and it was funded on January 1st, so it's $25 million, and it's a IFA mandate. So on no other products, still focused on our strategies that we were managing last year. Across of our other portfolios, including yours, we had a very strong 2013. So our clients were delivering what they've asked us to do. So we're not on any watch lists. Our relationships seem to be very strong, and we're doing what our clients have set us out to do. On page 4 is the overview of the portfolio. Finished a quarter with $88 million. It's funny looking back. We were asked to put what the starting position was back in when you first hired us back in December of 08, and $27 million. So, we've been blessed with strong up markets since you funded, but it's just it's a nice to see the relationship grow with that. Looking on page 5, this is as you remember, we are a multi-manager portfolio, and we hire multiple managers, multiple styles and sub-styles, creating a portfolio to meet the client's risk and return expectations, and we do that through our research process and construction process, and diversify into managers that we have strong conviction in. And if you see that, in the middle column, you see conservative, pure, aggressive. Those are the different styles of managers that we classify those as, and then the different allocations. We have had a number of different, we haven't had any manager changes for the last 3 years, but we have had allocation changes and weighting changes, and with the cash withdrawals that you've made, one in November, we rebalanced the targets, some of our managers. The year before that, we had rebalanced to the strong, higher growth managers away from the conservative growth because they were underperforming. They had a very strong run. We did the same thing in the fall. We took some assets off the table from the strong growth, high growth managers. And then we had another withdrawal at the end of March, and we were still working on our allocation. We probably will have some additional adjustments to that. The reason why we haven't fully rebalanced the market environment for our conservative growth managers has not been very strong. So we had very, very strong performance, and all across small cap growth had done very well through March 31st. And we've had a pretty strong reversal in the small cap growth space. A lot of things that had done well in the previous year were sold off. And so even the conservative growth managers, they've actually done worse than some of the more aggressive managers, growth managers. So just to give you a highlight of it, it's nice to look back and see what we've done, but we're also experiencing something very different this quarter. And if you turn to the next page, and Doug, if you want to talk a little bit about the performance.
Yeah, so page six, as you see here, this is the quarter ending March 31st. So Adam's comments, we have another page to address this last month. But March 31st, we would say that these results are at the high end of our expectations. Typically because we've had this strong market, and what we've had is as we construct the portfolio, having managers that are a little bit more, we consider to be over full market cycle defensive, do fairly well, a bit above our expectations. And then also on the other side, some of our more aggressive growth managers, Castle Ark and EAM, have a strong run of performance at the high end or above our expectations. So we would consider this to be, this performance you're seeing March 31st, 2014, at the high end of our expectations. Let me take you to page, we have an update, page 9. What Adam is alluding to, and this is the first month of this quarter where we've seen a reversal in terms of performance. And really, as Adam noted, the market environment for some of what we'd consider to be our conservative growth managers, managers that typically outperform in down markets, which is what we have seen in the first month of the quarter, have struggled. Part of that is we feel is the market environment for the kinds of stocks that they like. So as Adam noted, software as a service companies, typically an area where these Stevens and Riverbridge find a lot of opportunities, had done very well the previous year and has been sold off this year. So we feel some of the underperformance is, it's a short-term time period, but it's also part of the environment in terms of those managers and where they like to find stocks. So we recognize it and we understand it, and we still feel as if those managers are investing along the same lines of what we expect them to do in terms of the kinds of companies that they like. So as we see the market environment change, we expect that performance to turn out of those managers that we expect to do well in down markets.
And that being said, we have no plans right now to replace any managers, but we do have an eye on Riverbridge. They have done extremely well for us and you in your portfolio. They've been here since the beginning. Unfortunately, their success and has led to a significant growth in assets. The product's been closed. They've really run the same strategy and the same number of names, the same amount of turnover. So we don't think what has changed with the asset growth has inhibited their ability to add value. We're just constantly challenging. We didn't like they sold a portion of their firm to an outside investor. And they're really, you know, that to us is a red flag. And so we are challenging ourselves. We still feel it has a strong place in the portfolio today. We are looking for a solid replacement. They've had a unique place in your portfolio where they've been able to hold up in down markets and actually perform well in up markets. A pretty unique return pattern, which is hard to duplicate, but we have other options and we're testing those, and we're looking for the right time and until, you know, when we vote through it through our committee. But if we do have a change, that'll be our target area, and we'll let you know prior to making that move.
Adam, if you did make a change, would you continue with that style and sub-style that they currently subscribe to?
We would definitely look for a conservative growth manager because that, based on the current lineup, we have two aggressive and two pure, and having exposure to a GARP or a conservative manager is, it's just, you know, we would like that, that balance, and the correlations of their excess returns would be favorable. It would be a good addition to the portfolio. And we just don't want to dump it, find a manager with, you know, a good track record and then not care about its place in the portfolio.
But the only red flag at this point is outside investment.
From an organizational standpoint, we're always a little bit leery when the founders of the firm sell a piece of the firm to an outside interest, because potential, and we watch very closely with this, and we haven't seen evidence of it yet, but they're selling it, so maybe they aren't as engaged because they've made a lot of money, or potential for the outside interest to push them to do things they wouldn't normally do. So we just want to make sure they're stewards of capital and they're going to do the right thing for our clients. So we naturally take, when these kinds of transactions happen, we naturally take a very skeptical view of that transaction happening. So we're watching it closely, but as Adam said, they've been successful, they've grown, and there might be a manager that could fit that space that's really hungry and could really fulfill that role in that portfolio. So we're taking a look at those and testing those out.
Okay, what would be a concern if this happened and then we all of a sudden we see the product not closed, and then the stocks go from 49 to 60, and then, you know, a change in the portfolio manager. These are the types of things that, if, you know, when an outside investor comes in, they're buying a product that's already closed. It's not a great investment, right? Other than a stream of cash flow, they want to take that $2 billion that they're running in that to 4 to 5, and they, you know, want to maximize that. They have other products that they're trying to grow in the organization. So the small cap is unique, it's closed, and nothing has really changed within the types of names that they're buying, the number of names, who's running the portfolio, who are the research analysts. So that gives us a little more comfort that we don't have to act quickly and say, you know, there's a red flag, we have to be out. Because they're still running the same strategy. They've been running that same strategy with the same amount of names for 20 years, so with the same people. So we do have that is a little bit of comfort. However, we have other managers on our list that are smaller, more nimble, you know, that might have a better place in the portfolio. But at this point, there's no reason to throw them out today. But they are where we're spending the most amount of time analyzing and looking for running different iterations of portfolios with different managers in that spot.
Taking you to page 10, so our goal is to generate those attractive risk-adjusted returns. We want that blue dot up and to the left above that yellow dot. So that really is our goal going forward. And as even we speak about that portfolio and having that conservative growth manager, those are key to generating those attractive risk-adjusted returns.
On page 11 is the attribution for the quarter. Our goal is to build portfolios that have very little of the excess returns generated from the sector and style at differences, and having the majority of the alpha generated from stock selection. The quarter was a small positive alpha, but very little from our sector selection, only 3 basis points. We try to mitigate that. And then the strong stock selection in healthcare and in weak in information technology, but overall, a slight positive. And on the next two pages, 12 and 13, shows the characteristics of the portfolio as well as the structure on the sector. We have a slight overweight to information technology and a small underweight to materials. The materials underweight will probably be persistent. Most of our growth managers don't like to buy commodity-based businesses. They don't find a growth story in betting on the price of a commodity. So that is an area where we'll have a structural underweight. The technology, we were probably underweight that a couple of years ago, so that one can move. Another structural underweight, it's hidden within healthcare, as we typically have an underweight to biotechnology. It's one of the areas where managers do not like buying companies that are have a lot of debt, one product, and it's a binary result from a government agency, that they want to see a name that it's more, that's like gambling for them. So if a company is losing money and they're just betting on approval, that's when stocks have been taking off. And we have actually seen that. And we've had, when biotech has been the strongest industry over the last year and a half. It's been a really strong, it's really tough. It's been a big headwind for this portfolio. And we have a couple managers that invest in biotech, and some do it based on, EAM in your portfolio does it more on a price momentum basis. So they'll be in names that are moving, which helps us stay in that space. But it is a very difficult space for active managers who like quality and earnings growth to get their hands around a company with debt, no earnings, and one product. So it will typically be underweight that. It's about 8% of the benchmark, and we usually are in the 3 to 5 range. So it's not a massive bet, but it is something that we structurally, it's hard to find 5 managers together that overweight biotechnology. So we'll typically have that headwind when biotech is running, and a tailwind when it's coming off. On a characteristics basis, the portfolio on a cap is in line with the benchmark. Valuation slightly higher on a forward and current PE, and slightly higher growth rates going forward. With our risk model, we're predicting it's very similar beta to the benchmark, which is what we're trying to do for you, with a predicted tracking error of 1.9, which is in line with where we want the portfolio to be. We have seen that tick up over the last couple quarters, and predictive tracking error is a slow moving, since it the model uses 60 months. So any uptick in current volatility will take a while for it to tick up. But we actually look at rolling 20 days, and we've seen a definite spike up over the last, since mid-March, since we've started to see the sell-off. But it's within our risk controls. It's within where we targeted the 3 to 5% tracking error range. And the next couple pages show what I was talking about, the colorful chart with the bars, there's two charts going on here. One is the predicted tracking error, which is the line, and then the makeup of that tracking error. 90% of the tracking error is coming from stock specific risk is what we're trying to do. Very little from industry, and almost none from style. So our portfolio is fairly style pure to the benchmark, very little deviations from the sectors and industry, and most of the risk coming from our stock specific. So that is what we're trying to do, and it's what our models are telling us is happening. And on the final page, on page 16, is just the makeup of the style differences within our risk model. It's almost very little to talk about. The style at the top, 2.76 in the top right, is 3% of our tracking error is coming from our style difference. So it's very little. If anything, it's just a little bit on a little underweight on growth exposures, which is how they define it, and overweight the medium-term momentum. And that actually will medium-term momentum has sold off, and that's what companies that did well last year sold off coming into this quarter. So it kind of, we were overexposed to that. Our companies, managers that hold these names that have done well, those names rallied over the last year, and they've been sold off. The short-term momentum is beating medium-term momentum this quarter. So we were underweight short-term momentum, which is kind of on purpose because we're not a short-term investor. And the next couple pages just go into the individual managers. And if there's anyone that we want to save the remaining time on talking, we talked a little bit about Riverbridge, but if there's anything else, we can stop for comments or questions.
Any questions, anybody?
I have a question. When they sell things that they're getting rid of, what do they buy? Do they hold cash or do they turn around and buy something else?
Oh, everything is fully invested. So it's, you know, we have managers that have very long-term views, 3 to 5 years. So they'll buy a company within their process and hold it 3 or 5 years. Now, some managers like to hold on to those until the valuation is fully present, or some have strong sell disciplines where they say, well, it reached this PE, it's time to go back into a new name that fits in their process. So they're not market timing, but what we have a bunch of managers that have very low turnover, and we've had a very strong run for the last couple of years in small cap growth. And being a low turnover, you have names, and they've done well, you have names that are highly appreciated. And on a valuation basis, if you look at our PE ratios, are pricey. And the market is pricey. It was shown that it was pricey because it sold off 10%. So, and the names that were even higher valuations based on their growth rates were sold off even more. So it's when you have higher turnover managers, they typically can reinvest in names that, you know, that are moving through the cycle. But when you have lower turnover managers, that typically, you like to see them cut those positions and trim them and reinvest the proceeds. And we're asking those questions. And if they can't seem to find new names because they've grown too much, and they can't buy a name underneath the market cap. It's one of the things we were watching with Riverbridge. If you can't, they own a lot of, they have a lot of money. They can't, if they can't buy a name within their under $2 billion because of the size, they're going to be owning 15% of the firm or outstanding shares. That is a problem. We haven't seen that problem because they've always invested in line or slightly higher than the benchmark since inception, so that their process lends itself to having a slightly higher cap. So if they were trying to live off the microcap names, they would never be able to do it with the assets that they run now. So,
hey Adam, I don't know if you talked about Riverbridge's performance over the last 6 months, 3 months or so. But is there any correlation between the sale of part of Riverbridge and their most recent performance? Do you think it's just random and there's no...
Random,
okay,
yeah.
So this is prospective.
Yeah. So we spend a lot of time just literally going tick by tick on the kinds of names that they're buying and selling to make sure that the process that they have executed in the past is consistent with what they're buying and selling today. So we do that every quarter. We do a quarterly call, and we see their holdings on a daily basis up on our screens so we can see what they're buying and selling.
Okay.
Just to make sure.
So kind of watching them prospectively is not necessarily a function of their past performance. It's just what you feel may transpire going forward.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's also a point in time. If I'm looking at both of these, and the one-year number was slightly behind the benchmark by like 50 basis points. But we also utilize the Russell Growth Defensive and Dynamic benchmarks, which breaks out the sub-style. Dynamic significantly outperformed the benchmark, and defensive was, you know, it's like 300 or 400 basis points. So they actually beat their more defensive benchmark. So it's another way that we look at performance. But if you look at it now, they're, you know, underperforming on a one-year basis by 100 basis points. It's probably still in line with what defensive is doing. So we haven't seen a massive departure from what we expected. And they actually, last year, I think they did better than we expected to do. Because they significantly outperform the defensive nature, or the defensive benchmark. So,
but the nature of your assignment, at some point, given their asset level, don't you want to replace them with another Riverbridge from 5 years ago?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That definitely is what our main focus is right now, is to find this type of manager and, you know, because they've done extremely well for the portfolio, not just on an absolute return, but on a relative return, and just being that anchor when, you know, we had tough times and there was tough downdrafts since, you know, really sharp underperformances in or downdrafts in small cap growth, and they were always the one kind of holding up the rest of the managers. So they are a challenge to find a perfect match, but we do have other GARP managers. Yep. We're just kind of running through those. But like I said, if we saw other things that led to, you know, those increase in names, buying names way above the benchmark, you know, a departure of someone key to the team because they've gotten paid out, you know, those are the types of red flags that we would want to not sit around and wait for.
But if we look at all the names, Riverbridge isn't the only one that's non-employee owned, right? So if you look at Lee Munder, they're 43% employee owned, same as Riverbridge. And then the next manager, Stevens Investments, only 20% employee owned.
Yeah.
So that shouldn't be the trigger.
No, it's the relationship that they have with their outside partner. And actually, it's funny because Stevens, when we first hired Stevens, they had zero. And Stevens was run. There was a lift out team from AIM, and they got these guys in, this young team, in to run the asset management for Stevens. And apparently, the head of Stevens has never given ownership to any asset management firm. So they actually negotiated a 20% stake in their firm. So, you know, it was skin in the game that they were able to garner. But, you know, you would like firms to have majority ownership or control of their company. But, you know, when we find a great team in an organization that where the interests are aligned with the clients, that's more important to us. But if they had gone from 100% to 20, now we're having a different conversation because it's they've lost what they had, you know, and now they're it's a new outside partner.
Yeah. And they've made a lot of money from selling some of the firms. So we worry about that too. We worry about people getting comfortable. Like with Lee Munder, the revenue of the actual product directly is tied into performance. So the PM, he actually gets paid more or less money if he doesn't deliver to his clients. So if he delivers to his clients, he gets a higher revenue share. So we like that. Asset base is low on his products. So his products and the success of his clients are directly tied to his compensation, which we like. Great question.
Great, yeah, good. And if we had more time, we could talk about the Lee Munder, because we were actually invested with them when they were Crosswind, mm-hmm. and they sold that team into Lee Munder, which took away a lot of our firm risk that we had issues with when they were with Crosswind. We always loved the team and didn't love the organization. And Lee Munder, as they pulled them in there, took away all the operational risk, all the ownership risk. It was a larger firm, but they're still operating as the small growth team within a larger organization, which a lot more comfort. And his ownership stakes were very, his revenue share and his ownership is actually in a bigger business now than it was when he was the only person at the other firm. So it's very complicated, but these are the things that we always want to look at. At the end of the day, where is the dollar flowing? And if it's flowing more to the people not doing the work, that's a problem.
Any other questions? If not, thank you for
great.
Coming.
Thanks.
That brings us to 7.
Thank you, Gordy.
Paul, it's all yours.
Thank you, Gordy. I'm going to start off with the first quarter 2014 quarterly performance report. Given the length of the agenda, I'm going to go fairly quickly. Starting on page 1, the capital market review. It was a first quarter GDP was plus 0.1%. That will most likely be revised to be a negative number, so it'll be our first negative GDP in a while. And it's all blame it on the weather. And from what we can tell, now we're into the second quarter. Bridgewater, the large hedge fund back in Connecticut, put out a piece recently saying that GDP is now running at a full 3% type of annualized return past this first quarter weather related. So maybe there's some truth in blaming the weather. And if you can't blame it on the weather, I say let's blame it on Russia because of the geopolitical events and concerns. Also had an effect in the markets in March. It helped the flight to risk and treasuries rallied a bit. Obviously, the slowdown in growth helped treasuries also. And we did have yields come down significantly from the 10-year benchmark U.S. T-bond at 3% at the end of the year to around 2.5% today. It's come down quite a bit. The NAREITs, our REITs index, had a very strong return in the first quarter. And overall, on pages 2 and 3, it was kind of a ho-hum quarter, but a positive quarter for the fund, up 1.5%. We were 30 basis points below our policy, so it's the first quarter in a long time that we actually trailed our policy. And we didn't trail by much, though, 30 basis points. We had 6 items on page 2 that helped returns, and 7 on page 3 that hindered. 4 of the 6 on page 2 were passive indices, so they're basically in line. Legato added 20 bips, and Dodge & Cox Fixed Income continues to perform quite strongly, adding 70. What hurt on page 3, Delaware Large Cap Growth down 90, Dodge & Cox Equity down 20, Cap Prospects down 50. Pyramus was the biggest attribution to the downside, down 200. And LSV down 50. PIMCO was down 20. And direct lending added 1.7% for the quarter. It was 50 below policy 2.2, our 9% annualized return. But we're still in the J curve, and to have a positive 1.7% for the quarter is not a terrible. I would say it's a good result, actually, given where we are. Pages 4 and 5, total portfolio with a positive quarter brought the assets up to $1.73 billion. And page 6, getting into the summary, you can see the 1.5 on the upper left for the fund versus 1.8 for policy. You can also see that 30 basis points differential has a difference of 34 places in ranking, 63rd versus 29. So it was a very narrow range for the quarter, and just missing by 30 basis points equates to 34 rankings, lower than policy. The good news going farther out is fiscal year to date, the first 9 months, up 14% above excess returns of 150 basis points and a ranking of 10th percentile. 3 years, 10% versus 8.8, and 5 years, 16.8 with a ranking of third. On the page 6, the total, going down to page 6 and 7, the U.S. equity was up 1.5 versus 1.9 on page 7 for the quarter, 40 basis points below the index, the 80-20 index split. Fiscal year to date, we're up 21.1 U.S. equities versus 19.6, gaining 150 basis points in 3 and 5 years, good returns and rankings. International, as I said, hurt with Pyramus down 200, overall down 60 bips versus plus 60 for the ACWI ex-U.S. index. That's a shortfall of 120, which brings fiscal year to date even at 16.2. Longer term, 3 years, we've added 90 basis points, and 5 years, up 190. So it was a poor quarter, but this combination of LSV and Pyramus has been strong going out 3-5 years. Fixed income was positive with Dodge & Cox about 80% of the assets, PIMCO the other 20, and Dodge & Cox with their corporate overweights. And corporates doing well once again, giving us a 2.3 for the composite, up 50 bips against the aggregate of 1.8, and year to date 4 versus 2.3. So you can see for the first quarter, bonds outperformed equities, and that held through April as well. Page 8, our real estate and direct lending, there's that good REIT return of 10.3% for the first quarter, although the one-year number, it's at 4.4, so obviously the three prior quarters were negative. In direct lending, we had a 1.7 for the quarter, and fiscal year to date, the 9 months, with these managers starting right before or after the fiscal year started, up 5.8 versus 6.7. Again, that's a good result for the J curve. And we'll show in April, we're kind of getting out of the J curve now and reaping the income that we should as we get closer to fully invested with these managers. Page 9, the 10-year return, 7.2 versus 6.7. And on page 10, our form of the attribution for the quarter, we were down and on the public market equities, down 15 in U.S., down 23 in international. Fixed income was up 13, and the fund overall was down 35 basis points. Page 11, getting into what Legato said a little bit, we've seen a shift the first quarter in April to more defensive type of names. I think I gave this report 3 months ago for the fourth quarter. I said the market had been focusing on revenue growth and rewarding those companies that were showing revenue growth, which were a minority, and they tended to be the social media type names, the Teslas of the world, and those were the names that got sold pretty hard in this most recent two-month period. And a shift went into utilities, up 9.4% for the quarter, healthcare and defenses names up 5.7%. The Kellogg's, Pepsi's of the world have been doing better recently. But you see the one-year number with the Russell 3000 up 22.6%. It's got characteristics of late cycle, and late cycle is when there's a shift to the more defensive type names. The problem with that there's no typical cycle these last few years with what's been going on with Fed policy and liquidity support to the markets by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, so it's hard to say what a cycle is anymore, but the market's acting like a late cycle, and in fact the energy sector's picked up too, which is another late cycle sector. So we shall see, although the last week or two we are back to kind of go to the races with small caps and the those social media type names taking off again. So we're going to go to page 16. This is Delaware, which was down for the quarter. You can see, again, number holdings 31 is a concentrated portfolio. We're kind of used to that lumpy set of returns from a concentrated portfolio. Although, as we'll show in a couple pages, their long-term numbers are quite good. Although for the quarter, They were down 90 basis points, page 17, total effects, far left bottom. And interaction effects, which is a kind of, when you look at selection effect, which was positive and allocation positive, interaction effects is kind of the trading done inter quarter from the start of the portfolio to the end. So the names they sold or the names they bought during that quarter adversely affected returns. Page 18. Bottom quarterly cumulative excess performance. It was a down quarter, but 9 of the last 12 have been positive. So overall, the 3 and 5 year numbers still are quite good. Go to page 21, Dodge & Cox equity. More diverse portfolio of 69 names. Are pretty familiar names on the far left, the top holdings that we've gotten to know over time. And then on page 22, their total effects were down 70 basis points for the quarter, primarily selection effect. Although the bottom of 23, once again, we see a decent trend of 6 of the last 9 quarters being positive, and the 3 down quarters were just small, not down by that much relative to the benchmark. I'm going to go to page 27. This is Legato. 9 of the last 12 quarters have been positive. And they just gave their report, so I won't spend much time on them. Capital Prospects, page 28, was down 50 bips for the quarter. Page 30, is their attribution, and page 31, 8 of the last 12 quarters have been positive on the bottom of XX performance. Peer miss on page 32 was the one that missed the most, down 1.4 versus plus 0.6 for the quarter, although 3 years and 5 years they have added value, as well as 7 years. Page 33, very diversified portfolio, 254 names. Again, this is the growth side of the international equity. LSV is the value, and we've seen a shift in the last quarter to value outperforming growth after growth had been outperforming value for a number of years. So it was a quarter where value outperformed growth, so that might explain part of their underperformance. LSV, page 35, plus 0.1% versus plus 0.6 for the same Aquiex U.S. Index. And 37, their attribution down 70 bips. Page 38 is fixed income. It was a quarter where, once again, for the quarter, the lower the quality, the higher the performance. BAA up 3.6 versus AAA up 1.1 for the quarter. Longer dated assets outperform as interest rates decline. As I said, the 10-year was at 3% at the end of the year, ended around 2.6 at the end of the quarter. And on page 39, we see the performance with Dodge and Cox, with their overweight to corporates having an outstanding quarter once again. Page 42, the last page, shows the shape of the yield curve at the bottom right, and you can see the orange line at the end of 2013 to the yellow March 2014, a drop of rates from about 7 years out. So in all, we had a positive quarter. We trailed our benchmark for the first time in a number of quarters, but not by much. There was some slippage in the quarter from the public market equity active managers. The passive managers, their rankings are quite high for 3-5 years. So we're passive. We're passive in what we deem to be efficient markets, and I think that we have a good mix overall, as I've said in the past. I will pause, take any questions before we go into April. Before I go into April.
Do you have any predictions for this quarter?
I'll give my guesses in when I talk about April. We had the compliance list. This is information only. We are not recommending any changes in status. And if you look at the 3- and 5-year alphas, they're quite strong along with the rankings for our active managers. And passive, large cap value, 45th percentile, 3 years. Large cap growth, 39th percentile, 3 years. S&P 500, 36th percentile for 5 years. So that's my kind of backing up what I said about in the U.S. equity large cap space, having passive representations, I think, a good thing. Okay, April and predictions. April was a month where the Russell 3000 was up 12 basis points for the month, a relatively flat month. Value outperformed growth, and small caps corrected. You see the 2000 down 3.9%. Small caps, from their height to the bottom a few days ago, corrected just about 10%, the Russell 2000. It has since rallied fairly nicely the last few days, though. Year-to-date, the Russell 3000 was up 2.1%. The aggregate bond up 2.7%. So bonds have outperformed stocks through the end of April. Emerging markets continues to lag, flat for the year, and the one-year number down 1.5%, with the Russell 3000 up 20.8%. And corporate bonds, once again, were strong in April, up 66 bips for the high yield master index and up 3.7 for the year to date. It appears the market doesn't want to correct really hard here. It's had a chance, I think, and we've had geopolitical risk with Russia. We've had the Russell 2000 correct almost 10%. But the, you know, the headline indices, the Dow Jones and the S&P 500, held well even during the period when small caps corrected. And they've rallied these last few days, as I said. And they've rallied fairly hard. The 2000 index this month is now up with today's action over 4% month to date. The larger caps are up 2%. Non-US is up around 2%. And I think the big story are bonds. Bonds, when everyone's saying yields were going to rise at the end of last year, they've fallen significantly. And I think it's just a symptom of bonds recognizing that inflation is not an issue right now. And I think that's why we see gold continues to fall, because gold is primarily an inflation hedge at the end of the day. And if there's not inflation, you see the price of gold falling in the 10-year around in the low 250s. So with yields where they are, I don't see the equity markets falling hard. Not to say that we'll get a 5-10% correction in, you know, U.S., but I don't see it beyond that. And I think we correct by going flat for time. That's my prediction, that there won't be a correction down in prices hard, but we'll kind of be in a range, and the range will be kind of flat to maybe slightly higher, where we end the year slightly positive, and we let time be the correction rather than price.
How's money flowing into and out of the equity and fixed income markets? Is there a balance there?
I think you're seeing it more. We're not seeing the flows in the EM yet, that's for sure. That's where the valuation is. But within the U.S., I think it's, you know, given where yields are, there's not money flowing out of equities. I think it's just churning within.
I see.
This would be my guess. But fortunately, we have a real long-term perspective, and I can be wrong. And probably would be.
It's just interesting that yields are remaining low, even going lower, and the equity markets are fairly strong.
I mean, your yield in quality large caps is higher than the 2.5% 10-year now, right?
Yeah, but the 10-year's up still 100 basis points over a year ago. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you did have a move.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. I was just comparing to year-end, but yes.
Yeah, year-end is down, but
yeah,
12-month period, it's up 100 basis points.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fed has said that there needs to be inflation. So you have kind of a confused market right now, right? Because that means gold should rise. If you have an inflationary period, then you would have a rising gold market, but you have a gold market that's selling off along with the bond market since the end of the year, which bodes well. And you have a housing starts that are all 18-month low.
Yeah.
So we have a really confused market right now. Houses aren't being built at the clip they were just 3 months ago or 6 months ago. You have falling gold prices. You have falling yields in the short term on the 10-year, but up 100 basis over the last 12 months. And you have a Fed that says we need inflation. So equity shouldn't be going up.
Right.
It's a little scary.
Paul, you maybe I should have asked this earlier. Why on the peer review analysis, why do we leap from the crash from 14 and a quarter to 64? third ranking the next, especially since we've had a track record.
For the quarter?
Pretty good for the last 2 years, I guess.
Yeah, as I said, it was a, the return of the fund was a small return for the quarter, and when you put in all the funds in the universe, they were very close to one another, so that we were only 30 basis points below our policy, which was 29th percentile, and that 30 basis points equated to 34 placings, or 63rd percentile, as you just said, Mike. So the range was very narrow, and it didn't take much to go from 29th to 63rd percentile. So I would take that with a short period with a narrow range and a kind of a grain of salt type of thing.
Well, it's a big grain of salt. It was from 14 to 63.
Right. But it didn't, as you saw, that one quarter didn't affect our longer term 3 or 5 years hardly at all.
Right.
But obviously a few more quarters like that will affect it.
Right.
The other thing is the pack is tight. It's not there's a lot of distance between numbers.
April, page one, portfolio was up a bit for the month of April to $1.727 billion. Our percent allocations to current policy allocation is spot on. Our target policy longer term, obviously there's differences with direct lending being now over half of our 7.5% target, and we are addressing the balance of real estate today with infrastructure on deck. Page two, increase of $1.7 million from the prior month and $160 million from the prior year. Nice percent change there. Pages four, cash levels are low in public market equities, domestic and non-U.S. And page five, our performance. We did see a continuation of active underperformance in April for U.S. equities, with Dodge and Cox underperforming, Delaware slightly, and Legato, as they reported. Capital Prospects was the lone active manager that outperformed. For the 10-month period, we do see all the active managers outperforming except Legato now. Fixed income, kind of a continuation, Dodge and Cox outperforming, PIMCO underperforming a bit. The good news was direct lending with April, with Medley, Rave, and White Oak all positive for the month. And for the month combined, they were up 1.1% versus the 75 basis points benchmark, 9% annualized. And fiscal year to date now, that 10-month period, direct lending right at 7%. So that's good news given that we were in the J curve, kind of starting out with the investments. Now the portfolios are getting built up to the point where we're starting to see that net income being distributed to us in nice returns for the month of April. LSV, that red number should be blue for the month. They outperformed by 115 basis points and have a very good 10-month number. And Pyramus continued to underperform in April. Now down 2% for the 10-month period. BlackRock REITs continue to perform well, up 3.7%. And the fund overall was up 27 bips in April versus up 38 bips for policy. So we only trailed by 11 bips. And now we're up about, now we are up 14.35% for the first 10 months of the year. And it looks like May is going to be a positive month, too, unless we have a reversal of the last 3 days of the month. So that's the good news, is the fiscal year-to-date number, clearly. And despite the recent shortfalls of some of our active equity managers, we still have nice excess returns for the first 10 months of the year. I'll take any questions on April. Top 10, as I said, in the interest of time, there's nothing really significant to report, but we're in a month now of May where we're seeing positive returns in the equity markets, particularly U.S. small cap, which should lead to a positive month in May. I think that's it. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
We'll move on to item 8. We're skipping 8A, so 8B.
Okay. 8B is the 2014 quarter one value added report and this month or this quarter the cash flow report. Just to give you a reminder of what value added is, because I find myself sometimes forgetting the concept of measuring performance relative to a benchmark instead of looking at it on an absolute basis. So again, value added for our purposes today is simply looking at the excess return that the managers, our active managers, get and subtracting out the fees we pay to achieve those, or in an attempt to achieve those excess returns. So it's a benchmark relative strategy. And it assumes that we could earn the benchmark if we were to invest passively. That's a big assumption when you look at value added and try to interpret its results. So anyway, just a few highlights of the value added report, and that is this report here with all these numbers and stuff on it. The first quarter, this was the first losing quarter we had in terms of value added since June 30th, 2012. So it's been a year and three quarters since we have not added value to the portfolio relative to a passive strategy, which is really good. Active managers this quarter lost $4.6 million relative to a value added, or relative to a passive strategy. So had we invested passively over the last quarter, we would have had $4.6 million more than what we have today. Fixed income continues to add the greatest value. They still added $300,000 this quarter after fees. And Dodge & Cox fixed income has had only four losing quarters in the last 20. I still have an issue with the benchmark, and I know Paul and I have talked briefly about it. And I think that there are ways to look at them a little differently. I mean, one of the issues I have with the benchmark, using the same benchmark with Dodge & Cox and PIMCO, is the fact that Dodge & Cox is more heavily weighted into corporates. And essentially, the fixed income portfolio, since interest rates aren't going down anymore, the fixed income portfolio is probably expected to return what the yield is on the bond portfolio itself. And since corporates yield greater than treasuries in general, in most economic environments, Dodge & Cox is generally always going to outperform the benchmark relative to PIMCO. So I think there's a little disconnect there. I'm not saying Dodge & Cox is doing poorly, but I'm saying to take caution in looking at Dodge & Cox and PIMCO on the same basis, because it's not necessarily a fair comparison. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but that's
yeah, I never thought of that. I mean, obviously they're always overweight corporate.
Absolutely.
So maybe something like a 50% aggregate, 50% corporate type of benchmark might be.
And again, my only concern is just the comparing Dodge & Cox to PIMCO.
Yeah.
I have no allegiance to either one of those, but I mean, if we're going to look at them, I think we should look at them on an equal footing.
But it also explains why we pair PIMCO with
Absolutely.
Dodge & Cox.
Yes. Year over year, our active managers have added $18.2 million. So if you look at the performance over the last year, March 31st to March 31st, we have $18.2 million more in the portfolio had we been investing in a passive strategy. And PIMCO and Delaware were the only detractors over the year. Paul kind of alluded to that earlier with their return. They took $2 million from a passive strategy. And something that was very interesting, according to the way I put this report together, value style was the style that added the most value over the last year relative to all our other styles. Our total fee summary, that's this report right here, the second one. This actually expresses their fees in basis points relative to the total dollars that each individual manager is managing. The fees this quarter were actually 2.2 basis points lower than the quarterly average over the last year, and that's due to the new incentive structure, fee structure that we have with LSV. We paid about $124,000 less in fees to LSV for the first quarter of 2014 due to this strategy, which is about a 57% decrease over the average in terms of the data that I have, that I've looked at. But what's very, very interesting is that their custodial fees were also the highest they've ever been. And the custodial fees in this case for the LSV and Pyramus are directly correlated with the number of trades. And so I went back and looked, and sure enough, LSV did trade 23% more this quarter than they had on average in the past. I don't know if that's a function necessarily of this incentive fee structure. We kind of talked about this before we implemented this, that there could be a change in the behavior of some of the managers. But I will say, don't read anything into this in the first quarter. This is something that it's going to take us, I think, a couple years, 2 or 3 years, before we can accurately assess whether this is a good strategy for Stansara. This is one quarter. LSV did very well in April, so we're going to end up paying more next quarter if the results continue for the rest of this quarter. So it's a very interesting issue to watch. It's very fun and informative to watch and see where this thing goes.
Could make for an interesting discussion.
Absolutely. Yeah. I obviously, I'm a data person, and I can't make any inferences based on what I've seen in this first quarter, but I'm really...
Well, the only one you could make is probably premature.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to make inferences. It is way too soon.
Yeah, it was interesting when that is what's
Yeah.
What's really nice is the total plan paying 29 basis points for the last year. That's very reasonable given yes. our allocation to active managers.
Our total fee structure is pretty low. Yeah. It's below average relative to other 27 Act systems. It's not down in the 10th percentile, but we're definitely below the average of what most of the other systems pay. And that's pretty decent for a system the size of $2 billion. Generally, the systems our size are generally on the upper end of the fees that they pay to manage their money. And then the last thing on this item is the cash flow report. We had a little error. You got two cash flow reports. That was my fault. But the one that's relevant for today's discussion is the administrative cash flow report. And it's fairly self-explanatory, but if you want to take a look at that and ask some questions, I'm sure Kathy Herman would be happy to answer them.
That's where I spend all my fun time.
But again, it's pretty self-explanatory, and it shows where the money comes from and where it goes.
I thought it was really interesting.
The very last page.
Mm-hmm.
Rick, on your
kind of flat huh?
value add report,
yeah, but
of the other funds
really,
in the system,
for me it was really interesting.
How many actively manage the portfolio?
You mean the systems themselves
mm-hmm.
out of the 2037 Act systems? Okay, I don't know offhand, but I can make a fairly good educated guess. My guess would be probably 4 or 5. Orange, La Serra, San Bernardino, Contra Costa manages some, don't they?
I don't know about
that. And
them.
That's 4.
San Joaquin?
No. San Joaquin.
I think Alameda does.
And Alameda, right.
Alameda has some.
So I'd say 5 or 6 of them actually manage some part of their portfolio in-house.
In-house.
So 6. And I could be off 1 or 2. And that's all I have for item 8B.
HC? Gone.
Today I wanted to give you a very quick overview of something going on in Contra Costa County. Back in October of last year, the Contra Costa County Sheriffs and Firefighters Associations sued the retirement system and were trying to block the implementation of AB 197, which was the language that went into effect to define compensation earnable.
And so this has, they've gone to court several times, and they now have a judgment. The deputy sheriffs and the firefighters were asking to have, they, prior to the PEPRA legislation, they were having all of their termination cash out, their sick and new sick and vacation time. They were able to cash all of that out and get it included in their final average salary. At the end of this process, the judge decided that would not be allowed. However, for what legacy members, they are allowing them, if they were a member before the legacy legislation went into effect and they retire after this judgment, they can include either, whichever is lower, the amount of vacation time that they carried over on December 31st of 2012, or the amount that they actually cash out in their final compensation period. As you remember, you guys voted, and we are allowing our legacy members to include only what they cash out during their final average salary period. So this is very much in line with what you voted. And then the other notable change for them is that they, Contra Costa, when they started doing this, they eliminated on-call or standby pay completely. And the folks suing were asking to have that included again. So the judge went and he defined it more clearly that if the legacy member is required to work that on-call or standby time, and it is required of others in the same job class and is paid at the same rate as, and these are the guys that normally do this job, if they meet all of that criteria, then the retirement system is to look at it on a case-by-case basis for each person to determine if all of this is met or if it looks like it was done specifically to spike salary. And again, this is right in line with what you guys chose to do at the time that PEPRA was implemented.
So we chose, just to refresh my memory, we chose to allow on-call pay. Mm-hmm. And we chose to essentially do what they're saying is to look and see if there's any abnormalities in the use of on-call pay.
Absolutely.
On-call pay when on-call is required as mm-hmm. part of your job, mm-hmm. not when you just volunteer
right.
for it.
Right.
So essentially, we decided to do what's mm-hmm. in.
So we were very encouraged that what the court decided is very much right in line with what you chose to do at the time.
Okay. Back to you, Rick, I guess.
Okay, this is item 8D, Stancera Monthly Staff Report. I'm going to talk about three of these items, and then I'm going to turn it over to Don and Kathy for the other two. In terms of organizational resources, item A here, over the last several months, we've spent a lot of time trying to assess where the organization is going over the next 5 to 10 years and trying to decide which resources we're going to need to meet our increasing needs over time. We know that we're going to have to be able to keep up with the growth in system assets, the growth in liabilities, the growth in benefit payouts and retirees. And what we're looking at doing is we're kind of taking a three-pronged approach here to try to figure out how we're going to meet those needs down the road. And we're looking at processes, we're looking at technologies, and we're looking at people. So we're thinking a combination of those three things will allow us to get to where we need to be within the next 5 to 10 years. I know I've met with a few of you one-on-one to discuss this issue. I plan on doing it with the rest of you over the next month or two before we actually bring this item to the board in a few months. But we are definitely looking at and seeing issues down the road in our ability to meet our demands that the system is going to place on us in terms of our resources. The other issue that we've been spending a lot of time on, and it's kind of come out of our look into our organizational resource needs over the next 3 to 5 years, is a data auditing process. For the last couple months, I think it's been Dawn, I've been spending a reasonable amount of time kind of digging down into the benefits process and how we deliver our benefits and looking at the processes very closely. And what we found is that several of the processes are being done manually. And they're being done manually because there's a lack of trust in the data that's in our system. Hmm. which is very annoying to me. I think it's really slowing things down, and I don't think we're being very efficient in the way we deliver a lot of our processes. So we have reinstituted a data auditing process, which was stopped how long ago?
We stopped about 2 years ago, but quite frankly, we had so many new staff members and people training other people that the auditing process just kind of got put on the back burner. We've already audited about 1,700 files. And what we know is that when we implemented our pension software, we were not able to bring detailed data in prior to 1999. So we know we knew we were bringing in data that was not
had not been scrubbed.
It had not been scrubbed. And so we after a lot of discussion, we came to the conclusion the only way to get there was to audit these files and clean them up from legacy payroll systems and things like that. So basically, just because of training and transition and new people, the auditing process got put on the back burner, and everybody just kept plugging along and doing their jobs as best they could.
So just to give you an example of one of the things that we first saw is that we were looking at the retirement estimate process. And what I found was that the retirement estimate process was being done on a piece of paper. And it had, this piece of paper here was full of calculations and data and stuff. And my question was, isn't our system able to calculate a retirement estimate? Well, yeah, but the data's not good. And so I think staff is probably spending half hour to an hour calculating retirement estimates. This is not going to work later on down the road. This is a process that's broken. And unless we can get the data fixed and get back to a situation where we can trust what our technology allows us to produce, our Tyler system allows us to produce, we're going to be bogged down in time spent doing retirement estimates. So once we get the data fixed and get it all right in our Tyler system, then we will be able to use the Tyler system to just spit out these retirement estimates.
We use the Tyler system. We just do a lot of manual work before we can use the Tyler system.
For comparison.
So I don't want to.
So it's a little frustrating. No, yeah, but it's a little frustrating. I don't think that we should be auditing every estimate that comes out of the system. I think that we should get to a point where we trust the data and we trust what the system is telling us.
What are your audits telling you? Is there deviations?
There is. Our audits tell us that there was a two-week period in 1988 that's just nowhere. There's absolutely no record of them. So when the county went from a monthly payroll to a biweekly payroll, 2 weeks were dropped. Our audit system tells us that between 1989 to 1980 or latest 2000, the county was sending us part-time hours that people hadn't actually ever paid for. And so our old records have part-time hours in them that don't belong there. So we're having to take part-time hours out. When all the buyback information was manual in the 80s, none of that is in our system. So people actually have purchased service that's not electronically accounted for in the Tyler system. So that's why we started literally manual audits. We really are aware of the stuff we're looking for. A lot of work's been done to create this process. All the staff has really contributed because we've learned from what we found and from history and the people that have worked here what the issues are. And so that's what we're doing going in, doing the research now, pulling up the old paper files, making sure we know when people started, if they changed jobs, if they worked part-time, if they bought something back. And it's nothing for a 20-year employee to have a couple of leave of absences and some missed time, and they work part-time for a while, and all of that has to be accounted for and then made correct in the system. So it's unfortunate, but we weren't surprised when we actually brought Tyler on board. We knew we had all this old legacy data that just we weren't able to bring in.
How do you know the error unless the retiree tells you? By the way, you guys haven't calculated for 5 years as long.
We go looking for it.
The retiree doesn't know. Generally, what we do is we audit the data that we got from the county over time. So we go back and we look for things that look strange, and then we ask the county, what's going on here? They tell us what the corrections are, and then we make them. That's the process, and it's brutal.
So the county records are accurate enough for you to go back to if you need to?
Yes, the county records are pretty accurate. We run into more problems with the city of Ceres. Our smaller districts, fortunately, they don't have lots of employees, so it's not that big of a deal. But what the county's done with the furloughs, quite frankly, in the last 5 years, is going to be a problem for us for years to come. Because the county instituted you had to state that you were retiring 1 year in advance in order to have the furloughs go away and you got your full pay. Well, shortly after they instituted that policy, they allowed people to state it in less than a year, and then they retroed them all back their furlough time and their vacation time. So almost for every single person that's retiring now, even if we do all the legacy chases and get their back records fixed, because of the furloughs and the county's policy, quite frankly, we have to look at that final average salary year, and we have to back out furlough time and plus in vacation time. And unfortunately, that's going to be an ongoing manual process for a long time.
Is the funding off because of this?
The funding?
Their
no.
portion, no.
Mm-hmm. No.
I checked manually several of the calculations, and the girls are doing a good job. It's just that they're spending too much time doing a good job, and that's what's annoying to me.
So it's annoying and disconcerting, but your recommendation is met.
No, I'm just telling you what we're doing. There is no recommendation.
Well,
what
they're asking is going to be, we need more help.
That's coming.
We're going through the process of cleaning the data. That's what we're doing.
But instead of just asking for more help, that's why we're evaluating all of our processes and our technology,
exactly.
to see how we can do more with less.
Right. I don't think the solution to meeting our long-term needs are any one thing. It's going to be a combination of a few things. Mm-hmm. And for me to sit here and tell you that we need more bodies is not the answer to the problem. We will need more bodies, but we're going to need more than more bodies. We're going to need to fix the processes that are broken right now. And that's kind of what we're doing right now.
I can tell you from my own experience, with the payroll data, you sit down and you work out a contract with Stan Sarah, buyback, prior part-time service, it's allowed. You go through this whole process, which you buy them back over 5 years, and then Stan Sarah staff gets notified after I've already bought it all back from county payroll, oh, by the way, we found another little period of time that wasn't included. So then they have to go back, reopen the file, recalculate the adjustment for that now found period of time. So that's the kind of things that happen. But staff does do a great job.
But the trigger is a potential retirement.
Yes.
Yes.
Or just
right now.
Yes, but
right,
we're trying
right
to get to where we don't have to wait
right.
for the potential
exactly.
retirement. We're trying to get, and we have. Like I said, we've already audited 1,700 files, and we have out of about 8,000 people. So out of 4,000, 5,000 active members, we've audited 1,700 files already.
Wow.
So we've done a lot of work on it. Like I said, we know what to look for.
So
we know what we're going to do.
Those 1,700 are
100%
certain.
Up to the point where we audited. And then, unfortunately, the county added furloughs.
So those are all okay, except we haven't figured out the furloughs.
Right.
So now as those come up, what was audited up until, say, 5 years ago, that is good. So now if that person's coming in to retire now, we need to audit the most recent 5 years. So we're already, we may have 20, 25 years already audited, and now we're on that particular person, it's just the most recent 5 years. So even though we still have some work to do on them, it's minimal compared to what we've already done on them.
Have you talked to the county much about it?
There's been a few things that their systems do differently than ours that would be helpful. Yes, we've had some ongoing.
Has there been like a working group, say,
identified
to the point that could you guys do this and this and really help us?
We've thought about that. We haven't taken that step yet. I mean, the answer to the question is, can you give us clean data from this point forward? Yeah. Is there a way to give us clean data?
Especially if the furloughs are a problem, is there any way that they could mitigate the information that comes to you?
Yes.
Just do away with the furloughs. And then put a stop to it.
Well, is the fact
there was a reason for furloughs.
I know that.
Now that the county's gone to electronic
payroll, it's
going to, I mean, you're not going to have to do this forever.
No, the county's had three or four payroll systems over the last 20 years. Stan Sarah's had two or three pension systems over the last 20 years. So, yes, the county's had PeopleSoft now since 1999, and we've had one pension system since 2006. So it's all coming together in a much cleaner fashion. We are able to pull the data in more detail than we ever could before, and the county is able to give it to us. We can catch it on every payroll when they do something goofy. We call them immediately. They fix it, get it to us right. So it's much, much cleaner now than it's ever been. But if even 10 years from now, if we ended up having to do a new pension system, you want your data as clean as possible. So the sooner we get that done, the better off we're all going to be going forward.
Of the 1,700, how many of them were clean or good records? Probably, there were 100%.
Probably none. We started with the oldest ones back. And they literally were on paper. The people we started with paper, actually 3x5 cards with their service records from the county. And we have had a lot of communication with them because the county had all this stuff on 3x5 cards. And we said, can we have your cards for a while? They said, yes. We went over and got the boxes and ran the cards through our scanners so that we now can electronically research these people instead of walking back across the street.
Yeah, so we don't have to go over there. We can look it up now, and now we manually enter it into our system.
Kathy, have you
looked
at
it? That's part of our awesome audit.
If we dedicated some folks that didn't have anything else to do but do these files, have you made an estimate on what it would take time-wise to go from 1,700 to the full 8,000 and just get it done?
I think it takes another year. The problem is there's so much.
Would it be like two people for a year and then it's all up to date? Or?
Yeah. My concern with that, we've gone round and round with this, is you really need to have some knowledge to dig through this stuff. And like now, some of our new people, Mary and Elaine, actually are our two newest employees in our office. They now have enough knowledge about retirement and Stan Sarah and our system that we feel very confident that now if we show them how to do the audits, we can take other stuff off their desk and they can start focusing on the audits. But it was just a matter of, if we bring temps in, it's like, yes, we're going to be focusing more and more on the audits now, so we're excited about getting them going again.
If we don't have a dedicated and legitimate way of fixing the problem, it feels like we're going to dither on it.
No.
Well, we have a process.
There's no fix.
We have a process in place.
But if we can get through 17,
sure
we can get through
8,000.
And we will.
Let them know you're coming back.
We absolutely
and maybe the county can give it.
Well, the county is like I said, it's much better than it's ever been. And the fact that we catch errors every single payroll stops them from becoming a major issue 5-6 years from now. Not us, not the county, had the ability to do this prior to 2006 with us getting the system we have. And I actually had a conversation with the Sacramento system, and they never did get accurate information from their courts because of the way they bring the payroll in. We get accurate information from the courts every payroll, just like we do the county. So we're forcing them to give it to us the way we do. So it is coming in accurate now. Furloughs are just a problem, and they're just going to be a problem because of the way the policy works.
So
we are making progress. We are going to get there. You'll see some serious progress here within the next 6 months, I expect.
So the system now, their payroll system, meshes with ours.
Yes, the interface is mesh, and if they don't mesh, we go back to them until they get them right.
They don't mesh and messes.
One of the things that has improved is, even with the furloughs, is that because of PEFRA, the employers are required now to report to us if there's a retro, they have to tell us what pay periods it was earned in, which before they all just came in a big lump, no documentation, no nothing to help us figure out, was this over six pay periods or 6 month pay, where's the pay periods? So we've worked with the county, we worked for months with them to get that. And so that is now one improvement that we are very grateful for. The county worked very well with us. And so that is improving the process. And someone asked what triggers the audit, if it's those retiring. Right now we have given priority to those retiring. And then we have changed both our buyback and estimate process. So it's good for you to know in case someone comes to you and says, you know, I put in this estimate request and they're telling me it's gonna be 3 months before, it could be 3 months before I get my estimates. The reason for that is because we're now doing the full audit before we give the estimates. And keeping in mind that those that are actually requesting estimates now are probably gonna be the ones retiring in the next 3 to 5 years. So this is going to also help give them better information on their estimates so that they can make better determinations of when they should retire. So it's going to slow down our estimate, getting our estimates out quickly, but they're going to get audited estimates.
I gather we're not trying to solve the problem today. You're going to come back with some ideas?
Oh, I think what we're telling you right now is we're just cleaning the
data. This is what we're doing. This is one of the things we're working on right now.
And I think we're excited because people have been in place long enough now that they've learned enough that we can start teaching them to do the next step. So we're excited about that.
Sounds right. Good.
I didn't think there was going to be that much interest in this topic. The last thing that I want to talk about here in this report is asset liability management. We have finished the first draft of the asset liability process. We've given a copy of it to the county, and what this policy describes is why we're going to be looking at pension de-risking and a general high-level overview of how we're going to accomplish this. And this is simply just the next step in the development of the so-called glide path approach to managing our pension risk, which is something that came out of the strategic plan last year. We've also just recently purchased a Bloomberg application, and we are able to now value our liabilities on a daily basis if we want, based on spot curves based on yield curves that we can pull off of Bloomberg and transform those into spot curves. So I think what we want to do is towards the end of the year, we want to be able to show you on a monthly or quarterly basis how the change in our liabilities are moving over time with it. They're getting cheaper, whether they're getting more expensive, and so forth. And those will help us, those price levels of our liabilities will help us decide trigger points for when we want to start pulling risk off the table. So that's
How are you going to coordinate the timing of giving stuff to the county and to the board? You're going to bring it to the board first, give it to the county first?
In terms of
information, whatever information.
Well, I think always stuff is going to come to the board of retirement first.
Okay, we'll see it and then give it.
Oh yeah, but we are going to be working with the county in trying to figure out what optimal trigger points are in terms of what the county can afford. Mm-hmm. We know that the ability to do anything meaningful is way out there right now. It's probably not even close. But if interest rates do start to trend up, inflation starts to tick up. Over the next year or two, if we allow ourselves to consider bonds on the low end of the investment grade scale, they would still be investment grade. If we would allow ourselves to consider that, we may only be 150 basis points away from doing something, at least starting down a path of pension de-risking, if we allow ourselves to push out on that credit curve, so to speak. So that's what we're doing in that area.
You can always start with a subset of the retirees.
And we are. What's in the policy, that's a good point. What we put in this policy that I was talking about, this first draft, is we're going to ask you guys later on down the road if we can go ahead and immunize one year of cash flows, say 10 years out there. That'll allow us to get our feet wet, determine what the headwinds are in terms of asset liability management, and do something meaningful. And at least we can say we're making progress towards a goal. All right.
Okay.
We got one more here really fast.
Next, we have a custody bank transition. As you know, May 1st was our transition date. And I've put in here, they removed about 1,300 domestic securities on May 1. It took about 9 days for everything to come over and settle. It really went quite smoothly. Northern Trust sent us daily updates as to how many securities were coming over from where, the cash, where it was going. They were very efficient in how they moved it. We had 31 countries that were open. We still have a couple of securities that are settling for various reasons. Greece just doesn't settle until May 30th or once at the end of the month. So we just have to wait till May 30th for the one Greece app that we have, which happens to be a cement company. We still think it's odd. We got a couple of those two odd physical securities, and both the managers that have them are looking at what they can do about it. They were acquired through some other company at some other time, so it's, they're looking into what they need to do with those. They currently are in the process of auditing Bank of New York's April numbers. And then we won't see anything as far as reports for auditing until June 30th. And that'll be the May reports, and then we'll get June's reports 10 days later. And we can see everything we want to see online. We have electronic access to the accounts, so visually we call the accounts and the statements, so just not the audited statements. The balances, the daily balances are right in line with every other report we have. What Paul tells us, we have no reason to think, you know, there's anything that didn't happen like it should have. And we're not expecting any big holes to show up. It was a pretty clean transfer from everything we can see. And we're currently using the electronic web movement to draw our cash down. No more memos. We don't have to type memos and sign in fax and all that good stuff anymore. It's pretty exciting stuff, and it moved pretty well.
And I get the last one on the 5 for 5 this week, and I am very proud to tell you that we had another successful pre-retirement seminar. We've been doing this for more than 20 years, so every May, because May is retirement month, we do put on a half-day program. It's changed over the years. Currently, it's a half-day program. This year we had 169 attendees, we had 8 different speakers, and we had 13 different vendor tables set up at our vendor fair across the hall at Harvest Hall, which had 2 to 4 people at each of those tables, so there were a lot of people there to greet our upcoming retirees, and that included RESCO, Valley First Credit Union, Mass Mutual, Patrick's office, the insurance carriers themselves. We have Kaiser there and a couple of others, and then a lot of volunteer organizations. And this is a huge event that we have every year. It takes something from every division of this office to pull this all together, from our IT coordinator to our receptionist taking the reservations and our speakers and getting together all of the information that we give out to these folks. And we do evaluations at the end of the presentations, and there were very high marks. It was very well received this year, and it was very successful. So we just wanted to let you know we have a lot of happy upcoming retirees out there.
We're in a closed session coming up.
Yes.
The session will back and forth.
Yes.
All righty. We're done with item 8. Move on to 9, which is closed session, so I'll need a motion.
Make a motion to move into closed session.
Second.
Okay. Moved and seconded. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Back in session.
For recording purposes, it makes it.
Thank you.
Yeah, very systematic.
No, you're good. No, you're fine.
Without saying, hey, look, listen here. I think it's going to change. It shows the highlights. Is reporting on the non-traded REITs. Because he doesn't have a dog in the hunt.
Yeah.
A lot of them. So there's 3 reporting on the same account. Stagger.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So he's just. Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Great. Where, are those the hot seats down
far
there?
Far in, please.
All right. Thank you.
I mean, all he sells is his time.
So we're going to have a presentation from you and allow some time for question and answers. And we're supposed to be within about a half hour, right?
Yes. And I have cards for the board secretary.
So you can.
So let me begin by saying thank you very much. We're Morgan Stanley. We very much appreciate the opportunity today to present. We know your time is valuable, so we're going to do everything we can to keep you on schedule. By way of introduction, I'm Rob Harkins. I know some of you, but for those who don't know me, I do institutional development and relationship management work. I'm based in Los Angeles, where I've lived for the last 20 years. And with me is Josh Meyerberg and Megan Golder. Josh is one of four senior investors who manage our prime property fund day to day. Josh's background is in acquisitions, and consistent with this, focuses on this aspect of the fund's management. Josh is based in San Francisco, and if you were to feel that we're the right manager for you, we propose that Josh be your senior investor contact. Megan is in her seventh year at Morgan Stanley. She's a vice president in our real estate investing group. And on the Prime Property Fund, Megan's role is a dedicated client relations resource. And were you to choose us, she would be an integral part of the Morgan Stanley team that would be interfacing with you. In keeping with the agenda, we've geared our comments to be just a little less than 30 minutes. We hope that that helps you gain a couple of minutes today. And if it's okay with you, what we'd like to do is to begin by having Josh give an overview of the Morgan Stanley real estate investment platform, do a few key highlights of the Prime Property Fund itself, and then we'd like to go right to the portfolio itself and take a look at some of the portfolio characteristics, and with the aim of giving you an idea of what the approach is to portfolio construction and, importantly, risk control. And then with that done, we're going to have Megan go and review the fund's debt strategy, take a look at one or two performance measures, and then we'll end and open a Q&A after Megan reviews our current client base and some of the ways in which it has grown in a controlled fashion over time. So if you will take your presentation book and lift up Section 1, go to the title, says Section 1, lift up and go to page 9, and we will begin with the overview of the Morgan Stanley Real Estate Investing Platform.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. And I want to thank everybody in this room for giving us the opportunity and time today. We very much appreciate it, and we'll move through this quickly. We've given you a very big book here. Our intention is not to flip through every page of the book. We'll just hit on some highlights and move through quickly in the interest of time. Page 9, I think, is a good place to start. I think this gives us a good snapshot of who we are and what we do. In short, Prime Property Fund is a strategic investor in core real estate assets. Our business model is one that focuses on best-of-breed assets, markets, and operating strategies, and I'll take you through each of those and our thoughts on each of those and how we manage them as we move through the presentation today. Our portfolio dates back 41 years. I think this is an important point because the tenure of the fund has allowed us, through multiple economic cycles, to acquire assets and prune the portfolio so that what we are left with today is a portfolio of very high-quality assets that perform well throughout the economic cycle. I think it's a critical point on this page to emphasize that Prime is Morgan Stanley Real Estate's only core vehicle. And why this is important to everybody in this room is that we don't share opportunities with other separate accounts. We don't share opportunities with other commingled funds. We are Morgan Stanley's core vehicle. It also means that 75% of U.S. assets under management for Morgan Stanley Real Estate are within Prime. And we'll talk about the breadth and depth of our team later on. It means that our team is focused on this vehicle and their time is spent on this vehicle. A couple other things to highlight quickly on this page. The fund is run by two senior executives, Scott Brown and Candace Todd. They have both have 20 plus years of experience and dedication to Prime Property Fund. A lot of tenure, and again, as we talk through the history of the fund,
it really resides with those two individuals who continue to play leadership roles today. And all of these factors, everything we've talked about, our dedication, our team, our strategies, have contributed to outperformance through pretty much any measurable time period that we are measured against with regard to the benchmark. 1, 3, 5, and 10 years, we continue to outperform, and Meg will talk about this in more detail later on. Why don't we skip ahead a little bit to page 11, which gives a good snapshot of some of the metrics of the fund. We are $13.6 billion in real estate assets, $10.5 billion of equity, 22.7% levered, which is a little bit below our target. Meg will touch on that a little bit later. Three key numbers on this page to focus on, though. One is that we are 94% leased. This, to me, tells two stories. One, it speaks to the quality of our assets. Our office portfolio is 96% leased, which is well above the national average. The other thing that this metric highlights is that because we have good assets and because they're well leased, tenants want to be in them, it has allowed us to push rents and push rate over the last several years. In 2013, we were able to grow net operating income by 7%, which is a significant metric. Two other things to focus here is our long-term track record. The fund has been around since 1973. Our return has been 8.9% gross of fees since then. And in this bottom chart, you can see our track record. Again, over 1, 3, 5, and 10 years, we have consistently outperformed the benchmark. Let's flip over to page 12. There's a couple of takeaways here. Again, this page, as I mentioned earlier, highlights the tenure of our senior management team, Scott Brown and Candace Todd. I think more importantly, though, this highlights the breadth of the team and also is a good place to talk about our decision-making process. Our team is bi-coastal. We're headquartered in New York City, but we have 18 professionals in California, and our platform is committed to having a strong presence in California. I am local, as Rob said up front. I'm in San Francisco. 28% of our asset base is in California. As Meg will talk about later, we are investment managers for multiple different managers within the state of California. California is a key commitment for us. And I'm available to any member of the board that wants to come see our assets in San Francisco. We'll talk about that later. Wants to come down to LA, see our assets there, or wants to talk about our portfolio, what's going on in capital markets generally. We are a local resource, and we're committed to being that way. Last thing to touch on this page is our decision-making process. We have an independent board of directors, three independent board members. We also have an investment committee that interacts directly with the portfolio management team. So between an independent board, an independent investment committee, and our portfolio management team, there's good checks and balances in our system. Our decision-making process is disciplined and repeatable because we have these checks and balances in our system. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about the portfolio, and then I'll dive into strategies before handing it over to Meg. Page 14 is a great page, and when with the folks in this room, I think you'll be familiar with some of our assets. I want to start by talking about our San Francisco portfolio, which you'll see two of our assets here in Hills Plaza and One Maritime. Hills Plaza is frankly probably my favorite asset in our portfolio. It is the culmination of two of the key factors that are driving rents in San Francisco today, which is creative, quirky office space that tech tenants love, and views. And the views from this building, as you can see, it's on the waterfront, are all the way up and down the building. And this tenant has property has consistently stayed lease. Google has chosen this as their San Francisco headquarters and currently occupies more than 60% of the building. The other building to highlight in our San Francisco portfolio is One Maritime. This is another Class A, large institutional building right on the waterfront in the North Financial District in San Francisco. Bridge-to-bridge views, loyal tenant base. Again, we're well leased there, primarily to financial services companies. Our San Francisco portfolio highlights really the diversity of our tenant roster, the quality of our assets, I think is a good case study for folks in the room that are familiar with the San Francisco market about the types of buildings that we want to buy and that you guys would potentially invest in. The other assets to highlight here very quickly are our malls. This is a differentiating factor for us. Fashion Valley Mall is one of the highest grossing malls in the state of California. Dadeland Mall is one of the highest grossing malls in the state of Florida. these malls are very difficult to buy. When they come available, they're very expensive. Our portfolio in general, I would say, is very hard to replicate and expensive to replicate, and these malls are a big piece of that story. Let's skip ahead a couple of pages in the interest of time to page 17. I think this is a good place to tell the story of our investment strategy. To describe this page quickly, the pie chart on the left is prime property funds sector allocations. The chart on the right is the indexes, the benchmark indexes allocations. You'll see, with the possible exception of self-storage, which has been a strong performer for us, the chart on the left actually looks very similar to the chart on the right. So then the question is, why have we outperformed? And my answer to that question is two things. One, it is asset quality. And two, it's the strategies that we employ. So let me talk through each of those strategies real quickly. As we work our way around the pie chart, office, which is our biggest allocation, the majority of our holdings are high-quality Class A buildings in major markets, like Hills Plaza, like One Maritime. 86% of our portfolio is in major markets of Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, Boston, and New York City. We own very little suburban office, and we own very little in secondary and tertiary markets. Again, these types of assets have weathered the storm well through economic cycles. On the retail side, we are fortunate to have five large super regional malls, four of which we've owned for 25 years. So again, we talked earlier about the tenure of the fund and the opportunity that that has created for us. The malls is where you see it. Our recent acquisitions in retail have been locationally driven, what we call high street opportunities. For example, this is in Beverly Hills in LA. We are trying to find places that retailers want to be. There's lots of people buying things online these days. That makes physical real estate less valuable unless it is in locations where people want to go, where tourists will go. And that's Beverly Hills. That's Union Square. We don't own anything in Union Square in San Francisco, but we'd like to. This is where our retail strategy is focused today. On the industrial side, we focused on large institutional quality warehouses with close proximity to ports. I don't think we're terribly differentiated from our peers there, but that is where we're focused. And our apartment strategy, which we'll come back to, sits entirely with Amley. And again, I think that's a key differentiator for us. Before we talk about Amley, I want to talk about page 18, which shows our geographic concentration. As I said before, and we talk about risk mitigation, to us, being in the most liquid markets where tenants want to be and where people want to buy real estate is the best risk mitigation we can have in our portfolio. 70% of our portfolio is based in these large markets, and that is well above the benchmark and, again, a contributor to our outperformance. So now let me finish the discussion of our strategy. We'll flip over to page 24, and we'll talk about Amley. So simplistically, Amley is a company that is owned within our REIT. And Amley manages 100% of our apartment portfolio. So we have chosen to do this. We did this back in 2006. We took a public apartment company, and we bought them with our fund, and we've kept the management team in place. This accomplishes several goals for the fund, and frankly, it may have been the best investment that Prime has ever made. It aligns interests with our managers. Apartments as a sector are very management intensive. There are people at the property every day that face your tenants and talk to your tenants. Well, our managers are our employees, and their incentive is to create long-term value for us and for our fund and for our investors. And so every day they're at these apartment complexes, driving down costs, driving up rents, thinking like an owner. And that's an important differentiator for our platform relative to our peers. This also means that we have invested significantly in the platform and the brand. One of the most surprising statistics to me is that 72% of our leases are signed online. That is an investment in technology, again, on our part, and it speaks to the power of the Amley brand for renters in the markets where they are. They're not in the Bay Area, but they are in Chicago, and they're in Southern California, and they're in Houston. And they have significant control in strong submarkets. And renters that want to rent there, they go through Amley, and they rent online. The last thing to mention on the AMLI platform is this has been a key area of growth for us. We currently have roughly 6,900 units under development in 22 different projects within our existing AMLI markets. Not only are these developments producing outsized returns, they're also repositioning our portfolio for, in our view, the next recession. They're making it a more defensive apartment portfolio. We're selling older assets in more suburban locations and trading into new assets in urban and infill locations where younger demographics and baby boomers want to be. And by repositioning this portfolio, we believe that coming into the next recession, renters will want to be in our assets. They'll continue to move into places, geographies where their preferences would be, rather than going out in suburban locations and rather than going into older assets that require more capital. So I can pause there and hand it over to Meg to talk through our capitalization and our returns.
Can I ask a few questions before your transition? Number one, how do you set your dividend rate? It doesn't equal your NOI, so obviously you're holding some back.
Yep.
Two, will you ever close the fund in the future if the opportunities dissipate to the point where taking new capital may not make sense?
That's both good questions. On the dividend is set by the board. It's been 4%
for the last 3 years, I believe. Okay. The range is 2-4%, and we've been at 4% the last 3 years. We did decrease it during the financial crisis, but increased it coming out of it.
Your second question
on closing the
fund. This is a key strategic focus for our platform. As I said, 75% of our assets under management is in this fund. We continue to raise money and identify opportunities. And frankly, maybe this is the gist of your question. Finding opportunities is challenging in today's marketplace. There's no question. So what we have found as the best opportunities are investing in ourselves and our own portfolio. This has meant buying out joint venture partners in some cases. This has meant investing in AMLI. And this has meant being selective in the things that we buy. We're also investing $50 to $100 million a year within our portfolio to modernize buildings, make sure that our portfolio continues to be in the pristine condition that it is in today.
And logistically speaking, because we are an open-ended fund, we can accept capital as we need it. You know, there's no, we don't have to put out the capital.
Any other questions before we hand it over to Meg? Great.
All right. Now I'm just going to ask you to flip ahead to page 31, where it shows our debt profile. As Josh said, currently we're at 22.7% leverage. If you look over to the left, our target range is 25 to 35%. So we are slightly under our target range, but we do intend to increase it over the next couple of quarters. With that being said, we are generally 200 to 300 basis points above the benchmark. That's one place where we do generate, we do work to, generate a little extra return. We do have, as Josh said, a dedicated CFO. So managing debt is something, she does on a daily basis. The fund does go through the scrutiny of being rated by both Moody's and Standard & Poor's, and we're one of the only funds that do that. We're Baa2 and A- rating. We are third out of 70 real estate-related companies that are ranked by Standard & Poor's. Weighted average cost of debt is 4.7% with a 5.5-year remaining term. We also borrow on a secured and unsecured basis. Typically, we're 50-50. Over the last couple years, we have, used more secure debt just because it's been cheaper. So we do have the flexibility of using whichever type of debt is more cost efficient. The fund is 95% fixed. We do not take much, floating rate risk. Any floating debt is capped. Cash to net assets is 2.7%. Typically, we like to be under 1%, so we do expect to manage that down under the 1% level. And you can see the maturity schedule at the bottom. You can see very manageable terms. There is currently, we do mark the debt to market. There is currently a $60 million liability on the balance sheet. So as a potential investor, that's $60 million of embedded gain there. We will go through performance. Let's flip to page 36.
And Megan, can I interrupt one
sure.
second? You say on page 31 that the prime target, prime's target range for leverage is 25% to 35%.
Right.
Is the 35 the upper end? You won't go over that, or is there something that would trigger you?
Right. So the upper end is 50%.
Okay.
Although you know we do intend to stay within the target range. The only time we did go above that is during the financial crisis, and that wasn't us increasing the debt. That was just a factor of asset prices
Understood.
Dropping. So on page 36, there's a lot of bars on this page. The blue bars represent prime's before and after fee returns. So the darker blue is the before and the lighter blue is the after. The gold bar represents that of the index. You can see over every measurement period, with the exception of the 5-year, that prime's net returns have actually exceeded the gross returns of the index. So our after fee returns have been higher than the gross returns of the index, which is something that we're very proud of. Flipping to page 37, every asset in the fund is valued every quarter by an independent third party. And as I said, that includes the debt on the balance sheet. That's just the gold standard, we think, of of valuing that, valuing the portfolio. Page 38, this shows the fund's investor profile. You can see the fund is dominated by public pension funds like yourself, 35%. There's also corporate, 30% corporate pension plans. And as Rob said, we do have three public pension funds in California invested in the fund, and 11 investors in California. A couple of the pension funds are Orange County, they're a longtime investor in the fund, and Sacramento County is a new investor in the fund. Page 39. This shows the inflows and outflows to the fund. You can see at the on the top half of the page, since Morgan Stanley took over sponsorship in 2003, the fund has grown from 56 investors to 216. You can see the disciplined and controlled growth of the fund. The bottom table shows the inflows and outflows. You can see that the gold bars are much larger than the gray bars. We've been very well supported, both by new investors and existing investors. Looking.
So if you were fortunate enough to get our business at $15 million, given your Q, when would you guesstimate that would be called?
Yep. Our Q today is about 2 quarters, so we would expect to call your capital within 2 quarters.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, because the Q, as it shows on the left, is $879 million. We do anticipate calling $400 million. On June 30th, which will leave 479 plus any investments raised in the second quarter.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Meg. So just to flip to page 40 quickly, which is a good summary place to end on, just to reiterate, I think some of the key themes that you've heard today. Prime is part of a global investment manager in Morgan Stanley Real Estate, which is part of a big global organization that has 55,000 employees, 1,200 offices in 42 countries. And my job as your relationship manager is to deliver the firm. Prime Property Fund is the start, and we would love be very grateful to have Stan Serra as an investor in Prime. But if this board or any members of the board want to talk about capital markets or talk about financial advice, I'm here to help you facilitate that. And if you want to know what's going on in Dubai real estate or in Dubai capital markets, we're here to talk to you guys about that if you so choose. More importantly, though, Prime is a very important part of Morgan Stanley Real Estate. 75% of U.S. AUM, and it is our only core vehicle. Prime has had a long-tenured senior management team, as I've said repeatedly throughout the presentation, and it is a high-quality strategic portfolio has consistently outperformed the benchmark. And lastly, as I said, we're local, and I'm available to come down and speak to this board whenever you'd like me to come. So that's all we had as part of our prepared remarks. I'll open it up to any questions that you have.
I think we helped you pick up 5 minutes.
Good. Any questions from anybody?
What's the average investment across the platform among clients? I mean, is $15 million enough to get you guys out of bed in the morning, or is it just a drop in the bucket and of not real value or interest?
I'll let Meg address the specific number, but $15 million is very important to us.
Yes. I mean, of course it is. So our minimum investment is $5 million, so you're well over that. If you take the NAV of 10.5 divided by 216, I think it averages out to around 35, 40 million an investor. But again, we have plenty of investors that are smaller than that amount, and you know, some of the larger investors kind of offset that.
Anybody else?
Can you spend just a couple minutes and talk about your fee structure?
Yeah. There's a
tab A.
Tab A, yeah. So our base fee is 84 basis points. And again, the critical point here is that looking backwards, our fees may be a little higher than our competitors, but we've earned it, right? Our net of fees performance has outperformed the gross benchmark. But on page 46, you'll see our base fee is 84 basis points of NAV. And then our incentive fee is capped at 35 basis points, but I think the way it's calculated is critical in our alignment of interest with you guys as investors. We are paid to grow income. So what that means is that, and you can see the calculation here, what that means is that we wake up every day trying to think about how to increase rents. The valuation, as you guys know, is subject to many different assumptions, including cost of capital and cap rates and any number of other assumptions. Cash is real, though. And our goal as a portfolio management team is to maximize the cash that's coming out of our properties. And that's what the incentive fee is set up to do, is to reward us for doing our job and maximizing the cash flow coming off of our properties. So the total fee is capped at 119 basis points. But again, 84 is fixed and the 35 floats depending on how we do as a manager.
And I will say, so on the left-hand side of the page, you see our historical fee. We did modify the fee. We decreased the total fee last year. So if you look at the historical, you might have questions why some years it's above the 119. So it was modified last year.
Okay. Anybody else? Again, we have a time constraint. Love to talk to you longer, but you have to be reasonable. Thank you for coming.
Yes.
Great.
Thank you
very,
guys.
Very much for
thank
having
you.
Us.
Have these kites ever flown?
Yeah. Other
so is your Costco like industrial strength
kites?
I have maybe five.
So it must have been operator error as much as anything.
I mean, the size of that white part. Yes.
Lily, the night, she was the only one who wanted to get it in the year for 4 or 5 minutes. The rest of us just.
Far in, please.
Far in, yes, thank you.
Trying to keep them in the air. No kids, really. I can do this. You just got to do it like this.
Back in the old days.
As long as I continue to
run. Hi, how are you guys?
How are you?
Good. Welcome to Stan Sarah. And
thank
we're,
you.
As I understand it, we're giving you a half hour for presentation and questions. So if you're ready, we'll let you start.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having us in here. My name is Laura Gaylord. I head up the real estate, the marketing, and sales globally for Deutsche Asset and Wealth Management. And I'm joined today by Kevin Holley. Kevin is the lead portfolio manager for Reef America 2, which is our core open-end fund, our flagship core open-end fund, that we're going to be talking to you about today. Before we jump into the presentation, what I wanted to do is just give you a quick overview of our organization, how we fit within Deutsche Asset and Wealth Management. Kevin's going to spend just a little bit talking about the macro markets, what's going on in the real estate market, and then more importantly, where do we see the value proposition and the income that we see in our core fund today, and most importantly, probably for you making your investment, what does the future look like? And so we're going to spend some time talking about that. We also know your presentation before you, we want to try to differentiate ourselves, I think, a little bit to who you just heard from. We sound alike a little bit in core real estate, so we'll try our hardest to differentiate ourselves. I think what's important as we just set the stage here is we want to make this interactive, so please don't hesitate to stop us if you've got any questions as we go through our material here. So with that, let me turn to section one and talk a little bit about our firm. We are part of Deutsche Asset and Wealth Management. We fit within the alternative space of that. We are one of the largest alternative managers around the globe today, a little over $100 billion of assets under management. Of that, real estate represents about 33% of that total asset under management. I think if you look at us, we are a global platform. We have been for over 40 years. We certainly understand what's the importance of being a fiduciary. You can see our diversification as a firm both on the direct side, both in the U.S., Europe, as well as Asia. We're pretty well divided between Europe and the U.S. as well. Turning to page 8, you can see a little bit of our footprint here in the U.S. Again, we are one of the larger real estate investment advisors. On the direct side, we're managing almost $17 billion of assets under management. We have over 300 institutional clients that we're managing for in the U.S. I think it's important for you guys. We have 8 of the California counties that we are currently managing on behalf of, both in a core and value add, and Tulare County probably being our largest investor in REIF America too. I think a couple of things that I wanted to spend just a few moments before we turn it over to Kevin is talk about some of the things that I think distinguishes us in the business. And I talked a little bit about it, is we've been a fiduciary for over 40 years. We know the importance of communications, really staying in front of the good during the good times and also the challenging times. So we're focused on you as a client, and you'll see very much from our talk to any of the other California counties, we're very client-centric. I think the other thing is research has always been the hallmark of our organization, both from a macro standpoint as well as a bottom-up. Research guides us in our decisions on where we're making investments today and are an important part of the backbone of this organization. I think the other thing is we've seen a lot of transactions, buying and selling of real estate over our 40-year history. We have been a very active buyer over the last 18 months, and this year alone, we have looked to buy almost $1.5 billion of new opportunities. We'll talk about what some of those are specifically for this fund. But I think what's also important is we've been active sellers, and I think that's an important part and a discipline in our process that we've maintained both through the positive side of the market and also the challenging side. The other thing that I think we really learned out of the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008 is risk management. And that has been an important element. Banks obviously are focused on it, but I think really from our investment committee, really understanding what are the risks in underwriting investments. And that's a very disciplined approach that we take in buying and selling real estate today. Risk management is something that has been an important part of it. Also for us, we post-2007, we have a chief investment officer that is very much integrated to the research and then back to the portfolio management on our investment process. Again, a distinguishing factor in how we manage it. The other important part that I just want to touch upon here is asset management. We like to have boots on the ground, local asset management. We have 9 offices around the country. You can see them here on page 8. And it's talking about our asset management. We think that we've got offices in key markets that is feeding that information back to the portfolio managers, ensuring that we're making good decisions on behalf of our investors. And so we think that's a competitive advantage for us as well. And finally, I think on page 10, it says a lot about the performance and how we have continued to outperform not only over the last 1, 3, 5, and 10 years, but over the last 30 years. We have outperformed the index on a consistent relative risk-adjusted basis, and that has been very strong performance that we've been able to deliver back to our investors. So that's just a quick update, I think, on our organization, and now let me turn it over to Kevin to talk a little bit about CORE and then specifically about the fund that we're here to talk to you about today.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon. It's the end of a long day of meetings, it looks like. I see all the material and the candies and everything else, so welcome to the home stretch. I pardon my voice here. I've got a little bit of a chest cold, but I wanted to just share with you a few observations about the market you're about to invest in. This is your first real core real estate allocation for the fund on the private side. We've had a heck of a run for the last 5 years. I think you're probably wondering, gosh, are we coming in at the top, or are we, you know, what kind of environment are we investing into right now? And I think that's a pretty fair question. So a couple of things to say. On page 12, we just show why you invest in core real estate and remind you, and you probably are well aware of this already, that this is very strategic allocation for most investors. This is not a timing bet on the real estate market. This isn't with a lot of debt. This is really more of an income-driven investment that you're getting into here. And while the last few years we've had a lot of appreciation in our values and a lot of double-digit returns as a result, typically you would expect core real estate to give you most of your return, you know, two-thirds or so from current income, appreciation more or less tracking inflation. So, you know, in today's environment, returns in sort of the high single digits, somewhere in that range. That's sort of where we see the market shaping up for today. Real estate fundamentals are very good. The reasons you invest in this sector are all shown on this page, and I won't bore you with all of that, but, you know, low volatility, diversification, current income, and a lot of investors who, once they put their toe in the water with a fund like this, they like it, and they add other funds, and they expand their position, and it's been a very productive area for most investors. Inflation hedging characteristics and those kinds of things are also of interest today, although clearly inflation's not really front and center in a lot of people's thinking at the moment, but it's in the back of their brains for sure. The economy and the outlook that we have, I would say, from a real estate, I'm going to speak from a real estate perspective because of the limited time. This is an unusual real estate cycle because of what the Fed did. You know, they drove down the cost of money and it drove up the value of assets, and it had the most predominant effect on very high quality properties in very prime gateway markets. Those assets have clearly seen the most appreciation today. Laura touched on it. We're real estate operators. We're hands-on. We're different than a lot of other groups in that we buy, sell, manage our own properties. There's only two joint, this is an $8 billion fund. We have two joint ventures in the whole fund out of 125 investments, only two. And our partners have a tiny share of the equity in both of those deals. So we're very comfortable buying, managing, and selling. And what we're doing right now is we're very much interested in what I sort of euphemistically call the next chapter. And the next chapter for real estate, the next chapter of income growth and value growth, is coming into the markets that have been lagging this recovery and are coming forward now. So tech and energy less so, more coming into markets that, like in Southern California, for example, that haven't been at the forefront of this strong appreciation and where the fundamentals are improving. So in markets like San Francisco, which has been a great market, we have assets there, we've had great run on those assets, but in markets like San Francisco, you know, the supply pipeline is starting to gear back up. We're starting to get, there's a significant amount of apartment construction, there's office development now underway, there's a supply response to what's happened. Rents have reached replacement cost levels in that market, but there's a lot of markets in California and outside of California where that is not the case. But the fundamentals are improving. So we use a house view, and we update this every 6 months, and we're very transparent about it. We share it with all of our investors This is what we think about the markets. This is where we think you should go now. And we try to stay ahead. And so the two themes that I stress with people at the moment are good basis, meaning buy in at a good level, and a growth thesis for the income. So if we're buying at replacement cost levels or above, and if we're paying, if the tenants are already paying rents that are as high as they've ever been in the market, that to us is less exciting than a market where things are just starting to heat up or improve, and we think they're moving into a sweeter spot of the cycle, as long as the wheels don't come off the economy. So that's sort of, I just wanted to say that, just speaking pragmatically about the markets without getting into all these bullet points. That's really where our, I guess I would say our heads are at. The fundamentals are strong. The yields are good relative to alternatives. You know all of that already, I think. That's why you're looking at this fund. And so when we look at real estate, we're really approaching it with that in mind. Section 3 of the book talks about the fund, and I'm going to skip through this sort of rapidly again because I want you just to get a few key points, you know, that differentiate us from other funds and would make us worthy of investment. Our team is very proven. We've been together a long time. We have worked together on this fund with a large group of investors for many, many years. I've been the head portfolio manager of the fund for 11 years. And I have a fantastic team and great support from the organization. Couldn't ask for a better group of people to work with. The profile of the fund is on page 19. Some key statistics, $8 billion in gross assets. Conceived in 1998, we're a relative newcomer, but we're coming up on 20 years now, so we have a pretty good track record. This is a, you know, cycle-tested, well-defined, specified fund. You know what you're investing into. It's not in its infancy. It's not changing dramatically. It's a very stable fund. We have 225 institutional investors in the fund, so it's a very large, diversified event. All the big consultants, big plans, little plans, medium-sized plans in here, and very diversified. So it's cycle-tested. We own a lot of these assets at the peak in 07. We own them at the trough. We own them today. Its investor base is cycle-tested. We've gone through that cycle and the financial crisis successfully with a strong support from our investors. Low debt, we're at 24% currently loan-to-value, and very good diversification by tenant, by property, by market, however you want to cut it. This is a property portfolio that does not really ride on the coattails of one asset class or one market or one great investment that we made. It's a lot of good investments, and they rotate over time, and you can see that in the portfolio as the leadership changes over time. So it's a very large diversified portfolio. There's some pages here that show it. They give some flavor on our debt, and our returns are provided on page 23. I presume, I'll just make the presumption you've looked at all this, but we're ahead of the benchmark on the 1, 3, and 5. We have a very strong, steady, improving performance story, which I think we will continue to extend into the next couple of years. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to spend some time on that. But before I do, I just want to mention, when you look at performance of a core real estate fund, you really should be thinking income. Because I said earlier, income is two-thirds or more of your total return. On page 24, you can see the track record of this fund's income versus the benchmark. And this is a key point of differentiation. We don't chase appreciation. We really focus on income. We tend to be, I wouldn't say we're contrarian, we're not going to value add when people are buying core, but we're, like I said at the top of the thing, we're not chasing growth. We're really thinking about, when you look at our pipeline right now, what we're buying into markets where we think we can get that low basis, well below replacement cost, and strong growth in income. The assets that we're buying this year, on average, the income in place is 20% below today's fair market rent for the same space. So we're buying assets that we think we can grow income significantly, because income growth is going to be the driver. Cap rate compression, lower cost of money, that's kind of run its course. What's important now is being able to raise rents as a landlord and be able to drive your net income growth going forward. That is key, and that's something that we're very very focused on in terms of not doing right now, but where we want to be positioned for the next 3 to 5 years. That's basically our strong orientation. Before I jump into the forward-looking performance picture and just touch on that briefly, I just want to mention that we've attracted a lot of capital, but another key differentiating factor, like Laura said, we should really convey today. We are calling capital July 1st. You have the opportunity to be involved in that capital group if you're interested. So you would have some of your capital called July 1st. That's not something you get with everybody. So factor that into your thinking. It would probably be half or more. At least half of the capital would be called July 1st.
Can you, Kevin, address the debt schedule with 60% coming in the next 4 years? Should that be a concern of us?
Well, a portion of that is going to be retired, and a portion of that's going to be refinanced. So we actually have a map out what we're going to do, but I think we're in very good shape in terms of making our way through that period of time. What I think we're going to have in the about 2 quarters from now is around 4.6 or 4.7% weighted average cost of debt. And that's going to happen from debt rolling off and refinancing at these low rates that were available to us today. What your view is on where rates are going to be 2, 3, 4 years from now, you know, we'll all have to see. That's the risk. We'll see where it plays itself out. We do a fair valuation of our debt, and right now our debt's valued at about $40 million more than what we're carrying it for. So if interest rates go up, there's about $40 million of appreciation coming into the portfolio from the reversal of that adjustment to value, which is helpful. But I think our debt position versus the benchmark, which is, I'm not sure which benchmark, you're probably going to be using Odyssey, I assume, to mm-hmm. compare the yeah, performance. Compared to our benchmark, our cost of our debt and our blending of our debt, I feel, is very, you know, attractive, and I think we're in a good position to continue to keep the debt that attractive going forward, better than average. The investment plan is highlighted on page 27, and I just thought I'd close, and then so we have some time for Q&A. On kind of the forward look for the investment plan for the portfolio. And you can see that we have 8-10% on total return projected for 2014. Our first quarter was 2.9%. So, you know, I think we're on the right track for delivering those numbers. I said this is a cycle-tested portfolio, and 28 is an interesting graph in that it just shows you the value and the income from Reef America REIT 2 versus the peak on a same-store basis. And this is the vast majority of the portfolio that we're looking at here. So the same properties still haven't gotten to the value that they were in the last cycle, which is now 7 years ago. Same with the income. The income is just starting to get back up to the levels. And you can see on page 29 that the value is really in office and industrial. These apartments and retail have seen by far the strongest recovery, followed by office in the best markets, those top-tier markets I mentioned earlier, and the same sort of holds true with industrial. We like industrial and office more broadly as sector bets, if you will, over the next 3 years. Our house view calls them out as being outperformers for the next 3-4 years because of what's happening in those two areas. Strong fundamentals, not a lot of construction, rising rents, and we're positioned, we think, very well within this fund to play that. And you can see that on page 31, if you jump over 30 for a minute. The income growth, the net operating income growth that we have projected for 2015 is very significant in the office and in the industrial. And we've positioned ourselves here by design. This is where we want to be. I mentioned income growth is really key. We're projecting, these are just assets over $20 million, which again is the vast majority of this fund. They're 8.5% average net income growth, but much higher in office and industrial. And that's because we're in position in places like Orange County, California, for example. Orange County was one of the toughest hit office markets. We have, I think it's about $350 million of office down there today in a couple of projects. That is one of the top ranked markets in terms of rent growth over the next 5 years. We would rather be there than, quite frankly, down the street from Amazon in Seattle or here in San. As much as we like Seattle and San Francisco and we have positions in those markets, we think the better value play right now is in these places which are about to see higher growth and move into a phase where the landlord really has pricing power as they attract tenants. And then finally on page 30, this is about $800 million of assets, just these six assets. But this is giving you a sense of the value that's in the portfolio already. The San Francisco Design Center, some of you may know that property downtown, San Francisco South of Market. We're actually working with the city to change part of that property into office use. We have a tenant who wants to take the whole property, and there's a significant conversion and valuation write-up associated with that. Villa Marina down in Los Angeles in Marina Del Rey, we're working on entitlements for a third phase, which would involve residential over retail, and we already have a very large retail component there that's 100% leased. 1800 K is a prime corner in D.C. that we're renovating a building because a major tenant moved out. So we're going to move that building from a B building to an A building. And what you might get here is a little bit of a theme comes out, a couple of things. We like good properties and great locations that we can do something with. And we like to do it ourselves. We'd rather not bring in venture partners or create operating businesses because they cost a lot of money. There's a lot of leakage, quite frankly, of returns to you that goes out to those people for their efforts and services. This is controlled by us. You pay one fee, 95 basis points a year. You don't pay any add-ons. You don't pay any venture partners. You get the benefit of what we're doing with this real estate directly. And that's another key differentiating factor in investing with us versus the approach a lot of core funds use, which are very venture-oriented. I got a little bit of time. I guess I can talk about the three transactions in the pipeline, big deals we're working on that I thought you'd be interested in. Again, a lot of these themes are going to come out when I talk about these deals. One is a deal that's in the San Francisco Peninsula, where GoPro is headquartered. If you know GoPro, if you have kids, you know GoPro.
You're skiing.
My kids are all into GoPro, but the GoPro story is a very interesting one. There's about 4 years left on the lease there. Solar City is the other tenant in the park, another big growing company, and we are going to be working at restructuring that space into longer leases and putting that property back out probably on the market and selling it when we're done. But it's a very interesting play on the Mid Peninsula market right now and with some very interesting tenants. The property in New York on the far right is a very exciting deal. It's downtown. It's really just next to Tribeca, far north end of downtown. So core funds right now, many core funds are focusing on New York, and they might be buying in the Plaza District, which is Midtown Manhattan, and paying very high prices, record prices really, for that part of the city. We chose to invest down here because there's a huge change taking place downtown. There's been about $25 billion of public and private investment made in and around the World Trade Center site. And we are very excited about what's happening down there. So this property sits across the street from a brand new subway station. All the lines in New York come in and from Brooklyn also come into this subway station. A major tenant, retail tenant, has leased all the retail space, and I think we will probably condominiumize that at some fairly significant premium value over what we're buying the property at. And we have a long-term lease to a major credit tenant who burns off in a few years that I think will roll at much higher rents when we get there. So we're buying this property at those Midtown prime buildings are selling for well north of $1,000 a foot, as I mentioned, record prices. We're paying $460 a foot for the office space here in this project. And that, again, gets to the sort of value orientation. It's core. It's 100% leased. You're getting your income. It's competitive with the yield you'd get anywhere else. But it has this growth thesis behind it. The income in place is 20% below the market. 22% below market. And not only that, we think that the market rent is going to be 20% higher in 3 or 4 years than it is today. So that's the orientation we bring to you. If you want to look, say, well, what's the risk I take with that orientation? You can cycle test our strategy, the way we invest. It's this fund's been around 20 years. And the volatility on the downside and the write-downs and everything else that this fund went through was no different than the rest of the Odyssey benchmark. So we think we bring a lot in terms of the way we approach the market, the emphasis on income, the lack of leakage to venture partners, and positioning the fund where we think it needs to be for the next 3 to 5 years, which is different than where the market's been top performing over the last 3 to 5 years. So I'm going to stop there and then just answer any questions.
Let me ask you on the leverage ratio. You're saying 22% to 24% is a target. Is there a maximum?
30.
30 max. Okay.
30 is the max, yeah.
Any other questions from the board?
I have a question. Curious that there's no incentive fee in your fee structure. Why is that?
Well, I think it's primarily tied to the marketplace that we're in. We did have an incentive fee for many years in our fund and converted it about a year ago, I guess it was now, to a flat fee structure. It went to an investor vote, and there was a lot of discussion around it. The incentive fee that we had maybe was overly complex or complicated, but the notion, the feedback I got from talking to consultants is it's an open-end fund. So the view is, if you're not happy with performance, you can ask for your money out. And with the exception of the brief period following the financial crisis, this fund has always been able to honor redemptions in the quarter that they've been tendered. So that's the primary, and they say keep it simple, you know. So the average fee load for these funds tends to be about 110, 115 basis points all in, and we set it at 95. It's one size fits all, so if you're a $100 million, $200 million, or $5 million, which is our minimum investor, everybody pays the same fee, and it's been working.
I think the other most important part, it injected volatility into the returns. And so you as board members, you're sitting there looking at the returns, and there's a lot of volatility because of the performance fee. You're either lagging or leading the index. And so it's hard to make an apples to apples. It's harder. And what the feedback we got with investors is the most of our peer group is at a flat fee, right around 100, 110 bips that Kevin said. And so it was hard every quarter. The consultant had to explain why there's so much volatility always in those fees. And so I think when you looked at them, a peer-to-peer group, people, the feedback we got from a lot of investors and folks, they liked the flat fee.
So simplicity.
Yes.
Ours was kind of complicated too. Mm-hmm. I mean, ours had clawbacks and all sorts of features that really added to that volatility. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's right.
How leased are you right now? How leased up are you right now?
We're 92% overall, and a part of that reflects that, like, for example, Orange County, the properties right down there now are 80% leased. So, you know, we have positions where we're comfortable for the reasons that I stated. So our top-line occupancy is lowest in the office. Our apartments are 96%, I want to say.
What are you most excited about in the next 3 years in your portfolio?
I'm probably most excited about those embedded value propositions that I showed you.
The New York property.
Yeah.
The Soma property.
Taking what we own and investing in it and repositioning it.
I think, you know, what we've been good at is, you know, taking these assets and making them in good locations and just making them that much better. And I think that's we've demonstrated that over and over again with the abilities that we have in the portfolio. So it's a large portfolio. There's a lot of different assets in it. Some are more, you know, we focus on as a team. It changes year to year what we're focusing on. But right now, because of this, you know, this office movement that I talked about and the growth that we see happening there, we have a very good position in this portfolio to take advantage of that.
Thank you.
The other thing I'd say is the outlook, our house view for industrial and office is very positive. If you look at this fund, it's 25% compared to the Odyssey, which is 14%. So I think
on
that
industrial.
On industrial, right. And so I think that's another area that we see good opportunity or value proposition going forward.
Any other questions?
Yeah, is there one in the last 5 years that you wish you had not?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? In the last 5 years? Yeah. We've had, in the last 5 years, I would say no, really. Coming out of the recession, we didn't do much the first couple of years. And then the last few years, everything we purchased has done really well. So, no, I actually say think of 5 years. But if you look back beyond to the last cycle, I think Yeah, I think that there are assets in there. One thing that we did toward the end of the last cycle was we said, wow, you know, let's take some properties expand them, you know, or make them lease them up or make them different. So we bought one, for example, in Seattle that I wish we hadn't purchased at that point in the cycle. It's fine now, but at that point in the cycle, I wish we hadn't done it. So I'm not here to say we're perfect. That's for sure.
Is it hard to buy right now, given the last 5 years? And
yes.
If so, is there a point where you would close your fund or slow down on your queue because the opportunities just aren't there to accept new money?
Yeah, I think that it absolutely. What would happen, I don't think we would close the fund, but I think the message back to investors would be it's going to take longer to get the capital deployed here than we think. Luckily, the reason I can say what I said to you about the 50% is because we have these deals in the pipeline right now. We know we're buying those. It's challenging. Yeah, it's definitely challenging. It's competitive, but where I think we have a little bit of a differentiation is that we have these boots on the ground, people in the market every day. And, you know, I'm excited about the transactions that we're bringing on right now and every one of them and what they can do to the fund and what they're going to bring to the fund. So they're excellent risk-adjusted deals, and I think they demonstrate the strength of the firm.
I want to thank you for coming. It's an interesting subject. I'd like to spend a lot more time. No, as you know,
you. Thank you. Thank you for having us
things.
In. We appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for coming.
Is just the office, industrial, multifamily, and just an income producing.
We need to go back into closed session, so if I can get a motion.
So moved. Second.
Moved and second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay, we'll go back to closed session.
Oh, you do.
Back in open session.
Item 11B, the motion was by Donna Riley and seconded by Darren Garrett to approve the applicant's request to withdraw his application for a service-connected disability retirement. There was a roll call vote. Donna Riley, yes. Mike Lynch, yes. Darren Garrett, yes. Gordon Ford, yes. Jeff Grover, yes. Mike O'Neill, yes. Jason Gordo, yes. Motion carried. This was a withdrawal for application for Raymond Byers, 11B. There was a motion made for 11C. Motion was made by Darren Garrett and seconded by Donna Riley to deny the applicant, Serving Man. On her application for service-connected disability. Roll call vote, Donna Riley, yes. Mike Lynch, yes. Darren Garrett, yes. Gordon Ford, yes. Jeff Grover, yes. Mike O'Neill, yes. Jason Gordo, yes. Motion carried. No other items to report out.
Okay, we move on to members forum. I have nothing. Fred?
I have nothing.
Pass.
So I was invited to present at the LOFT conference at the end of June in Washington, D.C. And the LOFT conference is a Latino Public Employee Pension Trustee Forum. And I got selected because my last name, Gordo, they assumed I was Latino. And so they've asked me to speak at the conference about my experience as a trustee for Stancera. And I thought, okay, first of all, can you give me like how you picked me and what you want me to speak about? So they said, well, you have to be of Latino descent. That was number one. And then they gave forth. You know, I let him go, and I go, well, great, I'm not Latino. I'm like as Heinz 57 as they come. And he said, well, you don't have any Latino in you at all? No. So anyway, I go through the story. I said, my great-great-great-grandfather came over on a boat from Spain. He goes, that's fine with me. I mean,
they really want
I
to
said,
speak.
You are desperate.
Castile.
Yeah. So they want me to speak about my experiences as a board of trustee. I mean, I've only been here like 9 months. So
well, you should tell them about air travel.
Yeah. So they asked for your approval for me to go and speak, and I'd really like your denial for me to go. That's really
you
what
don't
I'm
want
asking.
To go?
No.
I will do whatever you want.
All right, perfect. That's all.
I don't have anything.
Oh, I attended Sacramento.
Why would we have to approve? It's just something they want?
Yeah, we denied it.
Member's request. I think we should see that. Member's request.
I attended the Sackers conference, Darren, and I thought it was a fairly interesting conference, and I always try to find one little nugget that somebody may, you know, leave out there. And we had that woman speak about technology, and it just occurred to me that maybe she had some self-interest going, but she said when you're looking at companies to invest in, you should really look at how they're handling their technology. Because technology should be pretty cheap if you're using the cloud and cloud-based. If you're still running your own system, she said they're spending way too much money on their computer technology if they have in-house IT people running their system. So I thought that's something I could bring back and share. And it just occurred to me that she also, her company is helping companies interact with technology and get tied up with the cloud. But I thought she was very happy. Did you go to that one, Darren?
I don't know if I did that one or not. If I did, it didn't stick. I didn't even recommend her to go to law.
She wasn't. Anyway.
Pass.
So I'm going to prolong your agony just for a couple more minutes.
No.
Okay. Indulge me. So at Sackers, in the CEO's roundtable, Bob Palmer, I don't know if you're all familiar with Bob Palmer, I'm sure some of you are. He represents Sackers in a lot of capacity. He approached the group there that day with regard to Sackers creating an advocacy group for the defined benefit up and down the state of California in response to anti-defined benefit propaganda that's going on out there. And so what he wants to do is he wanted to gauge the CEO's feel for if the 2037X system would be interested in doing this. It was brought up that they would pay for this by assessing each of the systems based on their asset value. What I got from there, without getting into any details for discussion, is that there was very little interest on the CEO's part. They didn't think that their boards would be that interested in doing something like that, but they did say that they would bring it to their boards and find out, you know, how their boards felt about it. So what I'm doing here is I'm fulfilling my part of this, and I'm asking you if you want to agendize this for a future agenda item to discuss contributing to an advocacy group for the defined benefit through Sackers.
Question. You're talking about a lobbying group?
Pretty much. Essentially, that would be the function.
They can't
lobby.
No, but they're lobbying for defined benefits.
Right.
They want to hire a lobbyist to go around the state and say good things about defined benefits.
Yes.
I wouldn't really be in favor of that.
I don't think we need an agenda item on that.
I think your sensibilities are...
Well, they have $250,000. I mean, Sackers is... They have a lot of money.
They are a lobbyist.
So without getting into any discussion, my thought has always been that we are plan administrators. We are not out there to promote the defined benefit. And I think that we should stick to what we do best, and that's administer the defined benefit.
You mean you got enough to do?
I don't want to fall into the CalPERS trap, because CalPERS does this. And
yeah.
I never thought that was the correct thing to do.
I don't think it needs to be agenda. I mean, if somebody has a specific proposal, have them send it to you and deal with it then, but there's nothing here.
Good. Thank you.
We stand adjourned.